I will call to order the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee for Thursday, March 9th. And our first bill on the agenda today is House File 1732. And I will move House File 1732, Representative Hoppe, to be re-referred to the General Register. And we'll ask you to go ahead and introduce yourself and set your bill up. And members, the part that is within the purview of our committee, just as Representative Hoppe sets the bill up and talks about it, is page 7, lines 7.28 through 7.32, having to do with the administrative law judge provision that's in being added to being considered as a part of this bill. So with that, Representative Hoppe, we'll turn it over to you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. I will do a very brief overview of the bill and then turn it over to the experts. I don't know if everybody in the committee knows, but insurance companies that do business in the state of Minnesota are subject to examinations or audits by our state's Department of Commerce. This bill, House File 1732, is looking to provide some sort of standards designed to bring more transparency, accountability, and predictability to those examinations. Ms. Rowan and Mr. Johnson have been working with the Department of Commerce. Progress has been made since the last committee hearing, and I would characterize what we're left with at this point as tinkering. If this passes today and goes to the General Register, we're not doing anything with it until we, I expect in the near future, we'll have an agreement with the department. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn over to the experts. Thank you.
Very good. Ms. Rowan, if you, or Mr. Johnson is going first. Mr. Johnson, if you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'm here representing property casualty companies, and Chairman Hoppe has described this examination function within the department. And to fulfill that, you all, the legislature, has given the Commerce Commissioner broad authority with specific duties and responsibilities. And we come up here and regularly work with you in the legislature and the Commerce Department to upgrade, modernize, make sure, Chairman Hoppe indicated, that we're having efficient and effective examination process. Specifically today, what we're addressing in recent years, we have seen within our industry this examination process start straying away from what we would, that model of efficient, effective examination process. There are standards at the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. That's an umbrella group of all 50 regulators, that they develop best practices and standards. And frankly, in this particular area of examinations, part of what's happened, we've seen the department has moved that function outside to third-party private vendors on a contract basis. And frankly, we have seen some significant deviations from what we would call the best practices, the most efficient practices. And frankly, that's why we're here today with House File 1732 to deal with this, as the chief author has indicated, these issues of transparency and communication and accountability. So I know those are some broad standards and words, but they're important, and they need to be codified in state law and specifically contained in those duties and responsibilities of the commissioner. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn over to Ms. Rowan on those specific points that you had flagged.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Ms. Rowan, if you'd identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. So while Mr. Johnson has the property and casualty side, I have life insurance, annuities, long-term care, disability, mutual funds, retirement plans. Mr. Johnson said, we're subject to these audits and exams, and what we've been struggling with recently is that if an insurance company isn't cooperating with the exam, the Department of Commerce can fine them, and that is a very motivating way for them to keep insurance companies cooperating with the exam if need be. But insurance companies, on the flip side, don't have any recourse, any meaningful recourse, if we have concerns with how the exam is being run. So, for example, recently we've seen things like exams in Minnesota tend to be 10 times more expensive than exams in other states. We've seen monthly bills as high as $150,000, and they're not itemized. They just come out as exams and travel. We've seen document requests that are way more expansive than the alleged violation that the department is looking for, sometimes going 10 years back from when the alleged questionable conduct occurred. And so we feel like we would like a meaningful process in place to be able to challenge when we see those that are, in our view, are excessive exercises of authority. So we've been working with the department very much to their credit. They've been working with us on establishing standards that make sense for the industry as well as for the regulator. And we've put in place in the bill a process where we can have an internal appeal to the commissioner. And after that, we can appeal that to the ALJ if the insurance company isn't happy with the result. And we all agree up to there. Where we don't agree yet is that we would like the ALJ's decision to be binding on the commissioner. It could still be appealed by either party to the Court of Appeal. But our view is that, as it currently stands, it's not a particularly meaningful recourse if the commissioner can ignore what the ALJ says. So the ALJ, we think the commissioner abused his authority. The ALJ agrees with us, and then the commissioner doesn't have to abide by what the ALJ determines. So we are still working with the department. We think we can come to something that makes sense for both of us. But as of now, we think this is a meaningful recourse.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm the chair of the Commerce Committee in the House, and I think I speak
That's where I recognize you from.
I think I speak for the chair of the Commerce Committee in the Senate, and I hope for all the members of both of the committees. We like the insurance industry in Minnesota. We also want to have long-term a strong Department of Commerce. We need to make sure that they are regulated and examined and audited, and I think this bill is just an attempt to try to fine-tune that process a little bit.
Members, questions for Ms. Rohn or Mr. Johnson? We do have a representative from the commissioner's office that will be speaking, but since they're here, if there's member questions, we'll just have you hang tight in case there are questions. Deputy Commissioner Brickwitty, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Assistant Commissioner Peter Brickwitty from the Commerce Department. I'll be brief, Mr. Chairman. I would echo Ms. Rowan's comments. We have been working together on the bill. We have two remaining concerns, one of which is the item before you under this committee's jurisdiction. The agency is concerned with the binding nature of the ALJ decision on the agency, which is a deviation from the process currently in place under Chapter 14 and under 78.22, upon which this process in the bill is modeled. But we will continue to work with the authors and the advocates again, I would echo the comments that we have been working together to try to craft a bill that can pass. We are opposed to the bill at the moment with those two remaining issues, but we are working to see if we can resolve them and happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Members, questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. Oh, no, actually, it's to the department. I'm sorry. I think the testifier has a valid point that if nobody's going to pay attention to the judge's determination, what's the point of going through that? All you'd really need is a mediator.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, understood, and the process under 78.22, upon which this language is modeled, the ALJ opinion is often upheld by the commissioner. There are, I think, only rare instances where there would be a deviation. That, however, has been the process that has been in place. The department does not have any other circumstances over which an administrative law judge decision would be binding on the agency. So we have concern that this would, in effect, flip the regulator-regulated entity relationship on its head a little bit. So that's why we're going to continue to work for a solution to see if we can find agreement with the author and the advocates.
Ms. Rohn, Mr. Johnson, either of you like to comment?
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Rohn.
I would just like to add that while this is a deviation from current practice with the Department of Commerce, there are 13 other instances in statute where the ALJ decision is binding on the agency. So it's not completely new.
Representative Mason, follow-up?
No, thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question I have has to do with the testifier mentioned that they can go back 10 so years, and I think there's something in here that says they can only go back 12 months. What happens if they find something was wrong? Can they then go back farther to, you know, just look into that violation or the discrepancy and are they stuck if we can only look back 12 months and maybe the, you know, at 13 months that information is there that would show that something was done wrong or prove that something wasn't done wrong?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, and I'll defer to Ms. Rowan for her perspective as well, too. You've identified the other issue that we are continuing to discuss with the advocates. We do have some concern about the 12-month time period is the time period in which the market conduct examination would need to be completed by the agency. We have concern about the ability, our ability to effectively complete the an examination in that amount of time, particularly in the event that decisions could be appealed into this ALJ process, and that may elongate the process. We have been discussing about how to accommodate appeals and making sure that that clock may stop in those circumstances, so we have not completed that discussion. We have been exchanging language back and forth to try to deal with that, but we would still be able to look back if there was, I think, alleged misconduct that we would be looking for in the exam that's more than 12 months, but the time period in which we would have to actually do the analysis would be limited to 12 months with the exceptions that are in the bill.
Ms. Rowan, did you also want to comment?
Representative Nelson, yes, Mr. Bickerty is correct. There's two different issues. There's nothing in the bill that would prevent them from looking back 10 years. They could look back 20 years if we want. We just want the ability, if we think that's crazy, to be able to address that. The 12 months, as Mr. Brickwitty indicated, that's the length of a total exam with some exceptions that we think take care of the needs.
Representative Nelson, follow-up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think I heard Representative Hoppe say that they're still working on this and you're going to be coming forward with working these issues out. Hopefully that happens before this gets brought up on the floor, because this is where it's going to the General Register, if I'm right. So
correct.
I hope that we get those, and I know Representative Hoppe's good about doing that, but I hope we see some changes in this before it gets to the floor and some agreement and peace in the valley before we hear this on the floor.
Having no other member questions right now, is there anyone present who would like to testify in the matter before the committee, House File 1732? Anyone wishing to come forward and testify on House File 1732? Seeing no other member questions, seeing no public testimony or persons wanting to comment, Representative Hoppe, we will give you the final word.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your time this morning. And as Representative Nelson said, we love peace in the valley.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 1732 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. Representative Hoppe, you are on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
As our agenda says, we will be able to kind of bounce around with bills today. We are going to take one of them for our time consideration here. House File 2058, Representative Nash, if you want to come forward. I understand this is simply a technical matter, and we'll take this right now before we get back into the rest of our agenda. And as you are making your way, Representative Nash, I will move House File 2058 to be re-referred to the General Register. And with that, Representative Nash, ask you to go ahead and proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, for taking the consideration for our testifier who is unable to be here later. Members, the utilization of eminent domain is a tool that exists for all different levels of government, and I'm not trying to take that away, but there exists in reality today that the Met Council doesn't have to play by the same rules as, say, another government agency like a city or a town or even MnDOT. And what we're trying to do here is to allow business owners that are going to be along an affected trainway to be treated the same that they would be treated if they were dealing with MnDOT. I have Mr. Coyle with me and the testifier here, and they would like to talk about that, and I'll turn that over to them.
Mr. Coyle, we'll start with you. Identify yourself for the record and proceed your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, good morning, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle with Larkin Hoffman. I represent a group of property owners whose land is situated in the light rail corridor for Southwest Light Rail. These are property owners whose land will be condemned based on the conversations they've had with the Met Council. This bill doesn't relate to the authority of the Met Council to proceed with that project. It only relates to the trying to assure that these landowners are fairly compensated based on the discrepancy that Representative Nash has identified. With that, I'll let Mr. Jabe testify with respect to his company.
Good morning, Mr. Jabe. Welcome to the committee. They'll state your name for the record, who you represent, proceed with your testimony, sir.
Okay, my name is Dwayne Jabe, and I'm representing Construction Materials Incorporated. And good morning, Mr. Chair. On behalf of my partners, my business partners, our employees, and other businesses up and down the Southwest Light Rail Corridor, I would like to say thank you for taking time to hear me this morning. Before I begin with my testimonial, I just wanted to, last Tuesday, I received a copy of the written testimony that was submitted by Met Council. And after reading the testimony, I felt this opportunity today to talk to you was something that I couldn't miss, so I rescheduled some things, and here we are. But in reading that testimonial, I kind of concluded that the end justified the means as far as the light rail situation goes. And an example of that might be if I'm running a race and I elbow four or five people out of the way to get to the finish line first, then that's okay because I achieved my goal. So anyway, I'll go ahead and continue with my testimonial. Okay, again, my name is Dwayne J. My business, the name of my business is Construction Materials Incorporated. We are located in St. Louis Park, very near Louisiana Avenue and Highway 7. We have been at this location for 51 years. We are a manufacturer and material supplier to the bridge and highway heavy construction industry. And we have experienced many years of success at this location and would like very much to continue doing business there. However, we recently received an offer from Metropolitan Council, and it appears as though we will be officially asked to leave. So Construction Materials is going to lose its current location due to construction of a light rail station. The property will become a new parking lot. However, our situation is a little bit different than the other property owners along the light rail corridor. We will be left with our property across the street from the lots, and the remaining property and building, Construction Materials cannot effectively compete in our market. So the only way for us to continue doing business is to pick up and move our entire business. We are a manufacturer, so difficulty in moving production lines, equipment, and inventory is the daunting task that we'll have before us. Seems very unfair to me that we will not be given full compensation for the loss of our business location, particularly when you consider the scope and substantial investment that Met Council has already made in this project. All we ask is that we receive the full benefit of the Minnesota condemnation law. Because of new circumstances like light rail, laws sometimes need to be amended, and I think that this law is one of them. I would ask you to support Representative Nash and his efforts, and many people in Minnesota will be better served by amending this law. On behalf of the many property owners that are currently being affected by the condemnation actions of Met Council, I would like to say thank you to Representative Nash for introducing this bill, and thank you for taking time to hear me today.
Members, questions for either Mr. Coyle at this time or Mr. Jabe? Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Jed Chetlin, are you from the Metropolitan Council? Do you want to come forward as well? And if there's any other members of the public who would like to testify on the matter before the committee, just ask you to see James, our page, and he'll get you queued up and get you your chance to visit with the committee today. Mr. Chetlin, welcome to the committee. If you state your name and who you represent for the record.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Judd Chetlin. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, so thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill. Mr. Chair and members, what is going on with this bill is that it's giving the impression that the Council is doing something that we shouldn't. And in fact, the way that the Council is approaching the eminent domain related to the Southwest Line is how we have that authority laid out in statute. We're approaching it as through our common carrier plan, so when the Council moves forward for something related to Metro Transit, we are proceeding under our common carrier authority, and under that we are considered a public service corporation. And so as we have brought this project forward and worked to be able to use the eminent domain to take these properties, we've been doing it using that authority. What happens with this bill is when you make that adjustment, we are in the position now where we have already put this project out for civil construction. We have our budget. We've been working with our federal partners. What happens with this bill is that we begin to add additional costs to the tune of $20 to $25 million for this project, and we are at the very back end of this project. So we are operating under our current authority. We've been proceeding that way since we began this project, and now we are here with this issue at the back end. And so we've been moving forward with state statute in our back pocket, showing us the way. And what I have is Peter Hamp, who's one of our attorneys for the Met Council, who's able to speak to any particular questions you may have related to it, but that is our testimony at this time.
So he's a phone a friend, not a testifier?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, I know you have a big agenda, so we will try to cut it short unless you have questions.
Members, questions for Mr. Chetnan. Representative Joachim.
And maybe this is to the statute. Maybe you can explain a little bit why public service corporation exceptions exist compared to possibly MnDOT.
Are you asking?
The phone a friend.
Okay. Let's state your name for the record, who you represent, and then we'll proceed with Representative Joachim's question of you.
And Mr. Chair, my name is Peter Hanf. I'm in-house counsel for the Metropolitan Council. The reason why the public service corporation exceptions exist, I don't know the answer specifically. I know what entities are included within that, and it's more of it's more related to function as opposed to entity. If you look at how it's defined in statute, it's utilities. So it could be public, it could be private. It's drainage authorities, it's watershed districts, and it's a common carrier, which could be public, it could be private. And so the legislature in 2006 made a determination that these entities for these functions should be excluded. Now the one thing that's not excluded is road authorities. And so what the author wants to do is compare this project, which is a different function, to a road project. And it's a different project.
Representative Joachim.
No, that's
okay. Other member questions. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not really sure who this will be to, but is this the rail line that already has two lawsuits against it?
Mr. Chetnan.
Mr. Chair and members, there currently are lawsuits related to the Southwest Line, but this is no different than how the Central Corridor Green Line moved forward as well. Our federal partners are well aware of these, but generally these get resolved, and so what is going on with this bill is different than a lawsuit. We're trying to change the law very late in the game here in order to, this is just happening pretty late.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Tice, follow up.
Thank you. I guess my question is not really where I'm going with it. I'm just kind of wondering why we're going forward with an eminent domain issue when, I mean, you haven't had any judgments passed down yet. You're not even sure what's going to happen. I mean, that's a concern of mine. And second, does anybody have any numbers of what we're talking about, the value of the property versus what he'll be getting under eminent domain?
Mr. Chetnan.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, we have had appraisals of all the properties along the line, and in fact there have been offers that have been put out at this point. And so all of the property owners that we are in the process of acquiring the property know what that is.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Case follow-up?
Yes, I guess I would like to know what some of the numbers are. I would think that would be something that should be available.
Mr. Chair and members, last night in transportation policy, I get them. We heard from the Met Council attorney that the amount that would actually be articulated for remuneration back to the property owners is in the $20 to $25 million range, and that's the whole thing. Is that these property owners, under the current situation, are going to lose out on that money that for the property that they rightfully own. And if this was a MnDOT project to move people from A to B, playing by the same rules, they would have to go through this more deliberative process, and they would have to pay the money that is actually been articulated, the $20 to $25 million, to these folks. And, you know, property rights, I think we all agree on property rights. That's pretty important stuff. And that's the whole reason for this bill, Mr. Chair.
We are getting quite a list of member questions at this time, so I'll put Representative Mason on. Representative Tice, follow up, then followed by Representative Pugh, followed by Representative Joachim, and I'll get to the rest as we get down the list.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Tice.
One of my first experiences with eminent domain was down here at the Capitol when I was president of the Central Minnesota Builders Association in 2007. And we actually came down to listen to an eminent domain issue that was happening in my district, and you know, it really is so bothersome to everybody, and it's just uncanny to me of how these numbers can't get a little bit closer together to relocate a business that's been around for 51 years. That's traumatic. I mean, you're looking at a lot of stuff, and to do it now and to do it to the codes now, I mean, you're not even going to get close, not even probably a quarter of what it's going to cost him to move. So I would really like to see us do some better work in this area. I just don't think it meets the needs at all. So I hope that we can do something. I hope there is an agreement, but I hope that it also looks at the landowner and the time. And, I mean, he's going to look at a couple years of building a new place. But also it is worrisome to me that we haven't even had a judgment yet, and yet it sounds like we're going to force somebody to get in the process of moving.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Nash, again for bringing this bill. This is the second time that I've heard this bill, and I'd like to start by thanking Mr. Jabe for being here again today, for rearranging your schedule. I thought about what you said in the previous committee that you testified before, and I haven't forgotten. I kept thinking about what you had said. I mean, property values, or property rights, yes, I mean, of course, very important, but I mean, the business, 51 years old, sounds like the piece of the property across the way will be condemned or whatever with regard to eminent domain. But then there's this other piece of your business, which obviously you're not going to be able to continue to function. And so, you know, we'll be forced. I'm just very upset also about the and perception becomes, you know, one's reality. The ends justify the means is how you felt about what was said to you in committee from the Met Council. And the Alinsky tactics, this is really very upsetting to me. So just because, I mean, I would say to Mr. Shetnan and the Metropolitan Council, the roadmap that you feel you have, the authority that you have been acting under with regard to the Public Service Corporation, you know, that you believe you have the right to do this, just because an entity like the Met Council has the right, doesn't make it right. And what I've heard here with this situation is just very wrong. So that was just a comment, no question. Right.
Representative Joaquin, followed by Representative West.
Thank
Representative
you.
Feiberg, I'll add you to the list as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know we did hear this in transportation last night, but it was late, and I could have asked these questions last night, and it just wasn't, I was getting tired last night. So I just wanted to quick ask Representative Nash, why the retroactivity on that date, on the bill?
Representative Nash.
I have the bill here.
Sure. Oh, so do I.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Coyle, if you wanted to come.
You know, the idea behind it is that, you know, many of these property owners have already known that their property is going to be condemned, so we wanted to make sure that they had a safety net to cover it. So,
Representative Joaquin, follow up.
Okay. Yes, I don't understand that, but and this is actually to Met Council now. I'm sorry, Mr. Shetnan or Mr. Hemp. I'm just trying to understand this because you know it does really concern me too because most of the properties that are being taken are in Hopkins. So. The Public Service Corporation exception, do you have to pay appraisal value at least, if not more?
So under the Public Service Corporation exception, public entities still have to reimburse owners for the value of their appraisal. The dollar amount is a little bit less.
Okay.
So it's instead of $5,000, it's
$1,500. Representative Joaquin, another follow-up?
Yeah, I was just trying to understand that. And I think one of the concerns is, I know there was some numbers thrown out earlier, and now it's coming back to me, that $25 million figure, Mr. Nash, Representative Nash, sorry, demoted you, Representative Nash, actually was for the extension of the blue line and the extension of the green line. So that's a lot, and there's a lot more properties being taken on the blue line extension than there will be in the green line extension. So you kind of have to put that into perspective. And I think the problem is we're changing rules again in midstream. So the Met Council is following the guidelines that were set by us in statute, and that's how they put the package together, and now that's changing. So that's, you know, some of the discussion, not that we shouldn't be having that discussion up here, but I want you to keep that in mind, that the rules are changing after everything's been set. So that makes it a little tough. So thank you.
Representative Mason, follow Representative Freiberg.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mason, I actually skipped Representative West. You are after Representative West. I'm sorry. Be fair to all members. Representative West, then Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for not skipping me. I just have to say, I don't have really any sympathy when you're talking about taking a property owner's land, which I understand it's going to cause some issues changing the rules midstream for the organization, but it's the somebody's land is getting taken against their will. I mean, this is like Revolutionary War style. Revolutionary War style, you know, commandeering by the government. And there needs to be, it's not just appraisal of the property and the value of the property. It's going to cost them a fortune to move, you know, the other aspects of their business. They don't just need to buy new land. They need to pay to move their equipment, buy new equipment, all of the above. And, you know, changing rules midstream sounds perfectly fine to me if it means we're actually getting some fairness. And to that point, I think if we fix the governance of the Met Council itself will be more responsive to the needs of private landowners.
Representative Mason.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I'll start with the author. First of all, I have a lot of concerns about eminent domain, no matter when it's used. But I do think that it is unfair to change the rules in midstream. So I have no problems with the amendment going forward, but as has pointed out, it doesn't seem to, it's not fair to make it go retroactive. So I'd really appreciate if you would take that out. Secondly, and the bill as a whole, and when I'm looking at all of these other entities that are used, especially the pipelines, and I can see benefit to Minnesotans for the transit and transportation things. There's benefit to our constituents. But like some of the entities, like the transmission lines and the pipelines, I mean, Minnesota's just used as they go through state. There's no benefit to the residents of Minnesota. So why wouldn't you also exempt those, take those up? Thank you.
And Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Representative Pugh. Oh.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just heard a statement. You're not close enough to the microphones for all of us to hear. So, Representative Mason, if you will draw in, that will help us all. Maybe you want to restate the questions. I'm not sure if the testifiers heard that there was a question there as well.
Okay.
So, Representative Mason, do you want to try again?
Okay. Well, I just want to say I have problems with the eminent domain no matter what. But I really believe that the going, making this retroactive is not fair to anybody. So I'd appreciate it if you would take that lead on. But more importantly, I can see the benefit for the light rail and transit to Minnesotans. But the fact that you're leaving the transmission lines and the pipelines out of the picture doesn't make sense to me, because those may not, in some cases, benefit Minnesotans at all. So why wouldn't you just deal with everything?
Mr. Coyle?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, we're not proposing any changes as it relates to pipeline companies or utility companies generally. They're already subject to the law to the extent that it's in statute today. We're not proposing any change. All we are asking is that property owners who are condemned under the Met Council's authority are treated the same as for any other transportation project, whether it's initiated by your city, by Dakota County, or by the state of Minnesota Department of Transportation. That's the extent of the bill. And the retroactivity piece is simply to protect the landowners in the current process who are beginning to receive offers from the Met Council, and we think that they're entitled to be protected fully to the extent that there is damages that they are beginning to incur because they have to defend themselves and plan for the relocation of their properties. It's simply a fairness question based on the existing statute as it applies to other government agencies. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if Representative Pugh would explain what Alinsky tactics are.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Freiberg. I would choose to use a different word than tactics, but what I heard What I heard Mr. Jabe say was, and the reason that he rescheduled his day to be here is because of what the Met Council said and how they, you know, how they will stop at nothing. And so, you know, for the record, I would just say that Alinsky is Saul Alinsky, and the ends justify the means is, in fact, you know, what I associate with when I think of Alinsky. And so, anyway, I just was responding and am really pleased that Mr. Jabe came back today to testify.
Having no other member questions, is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify in the matter that's before the commission, before the committee? Seeing none and no other member questions, Representative Nash will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And, you know, I think this is trying to be a cut and dry fairness thing, and there's obviously some emotions, and we can talk about those at another time. That wasn't part of what my goal was this morning. But, you know, this is all about the property rights of the people who are along these affected lines. And I know that all of you feel very strongly about eminent domain and the benefits that should be imparted to the property owners. But with that, Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call on this.
Roll call being requested. I will renew my motion that House File 2058 be re-referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Pugh?
Aye.
Bliss?
Yes.
Fenton?
Yes.
Freiberg?
Pass.
Halverson?
Yes.
Jessup?
Absolutely.
Lee?
Pass.
Mason?
Yes.
Nash?
Yes.
Nelson? Peters?
No.
Peterson? Quam?
Yes.
Zanstead?
Yes.
Trudzinski? Tice?
Yes.
West?
Yes.
Joachim?
Pass.
Before we do the roll, Representative Jessup, absolutely fill in for me the blank, if you would.
Yes.
Yes? Okay.
Freiberg?
No.
Lee?
No.
Joachim?
Yes.
There being 13 ayes and 3 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, we will bring down Representative Rarick for House File 630, and I will move House File 630 before the committee to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. And Representative Rarick, we'll ask you to go ahead and proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 630 is a bill dealing with reimbursing counties for child placement that are working through the Indian Child Welfare Act. I've been working very closely with all the groups involved. In one of our previous stops, we did an amendment. We took on the governor's language for this bill, and we've been having some conversations there. We are working with Mr. Cummings from the Department of Revenue. He is the one who is their department that did the governor's language. He is going to be getting a meeting together with his group, the DHS, the tribes and the counties. These are the groups working on the bill. There are a couple of issues yet that we need to have resolved when we get to taxes. They're the issues that will be figured on there. There are some perception pieces that we want to make sure are covered so that everything is clear and everybody's on the same base. So I guess with that, we do have some people that can help with specific questions, but that's the gist of the bill.
So you have some resources if the committee needs them. Members of the committee, questions for Representative Rarick on House File 630, which is before the committee at this time? Seeing no member questions right now, is there anybody from the public who would like to testify on House File 630? If so, please make your way to the testifying table. Seeing none, seeing no member questions, Representative Burke, we will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your support.
I will renew my motion that House File 630 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Security. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Burke, you are on your way. Representative Howe, as Representative Howe is making his way to the testifying table, I will move House File 1891 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Representative Howe, welcome to the committee. We'll proceed with your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And what this bill does is basically brings our negotiation piece here for the affirmative approval in line with everything else we do at the legislature. Instead of a tie saying it goes on and it's enacted, a tie like we see in everything else we do here at the legislature means it fails and it doesn't move on. So that's the gist of the bill, and I'll stand for any questions.
Member questions. Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howe, what currently happens if there's a tie?
If there's a tie?
Mm-hmm. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there's a tie, the bill, the negotiations, the agreements are enacted.
Okay.
Until such time as it goes to the legislature and gets either approved and or disapproved. The problem with that is that by the time the legislature gets a chance to look at it, when these agreements are made, when the legislature is not in session, and that's normally what we find, what happens then is by the time the legislature looks at it, a lot of times there's only a couple of months left on the contract, and it doesn't make any sense to disapprove it because you don't get to recollect all those wages that have already been paid. So to me, it just makes sense that it doesn't get approved. The contracts stay the same that are already enforced, and then at such time the legislature can take it up at the time. So that's, and I will say that everything else we do at the legislature, when it is a tie, it's a fail, and it doesn't move any further, and I believe it should be the same on these contract negotiations.
There are two individuals that would like to testify, and Representative Nelson, you did get on the list. Is there something specifically for this before you testify?
Okay.
I'll put you back on the list on here as well. With that, I would like to have Mr. Edwin Hudson come down, and if Mr. Richard Kolonjewski would like to also come down, and we'll get both of your testimony. And if there's anyone from the public that would like to testify on the matter, please see James R. Page. He'll get you queued in. We'll get you up to testify and share your thoughts with the commission. Mr. Hudson, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Edwin Hudson. I am the Deputy Commissioner for Enterprise Human Capital. And in the essence of time, I'll only have a few comments with regard to House File 1891. Thank you for having me here this morning. This process has been in place for over 20 years, and it's worked very well. And typically, this process follows a very lengthy negotiation with labor. And management and labor, they solve and they reach tentative agreements on language, economic issues, including wages and insurance. Now, the unions, they go through a lengthy process as well to get it ratified with their members. The current process allows for the SCR to meet within 30 days after the commissioner of MMB has signed off on the collective bargaining agreements. We believe this is adequate time for the subcommittee to gather a quorum to meet to take actions. Now, let me just share with you, interim approval is very helpful, and I'd like to share with you some of those ways that it's very helpful. Now, let's first talk about our health insurance. Health insurance plan typically begins, well, it does. It begins January of every year. If interim approval is not given, open enrollment may be delayed. Typically, open enrollment is from October to November of every year. Now, if there are any improvements that has been negotiated in the negotiation process. If we delay that process and are not allowed to proceed, then we cannot implement the insurance plans, and we would not be able to realize those improvements in insurance. And many of them are cost-saving improvements. Now, that would also put at risk our ability to implement these insurance plans that you yourselves enjoy. And the reason being is because we would not be able to get them implemented day one of the new year, January the 1st. And it's very difficult for us to manage two plans. We just simply do not have the resource to manage the current plan and the new plan. So we only have the wherewithal to manage one plan, and that would be the new and improved plan that would go forward. So for us to have any delays or for us to not be allowed to move forward with the tentative agreement would be problematic. Now, some other things I'd like to point out, too, that would be helpful. MMB is in the process of, we're in the process of implementing general adjustments, wage increases for our employees, which typically go into effect July the 1st. Now, this is a very timely process, and for us to delay that would be impactful there. And that is very helpful instrument and tools that our agencies use to recruit and retain employees. So we would not want to bother with that as well. Finally, I'll just add that interim approvals of the negotiated agreements send a signal to other bargaining units, and it helps us in the bargaining process. So typically we start off with our two largest bargaining agreements, AFSCME and MAPE. And once we get those approved, we forward them to you, and we get those approved and by the SER, one way or the other, we move forward with that. At that point, we can go back and negotiate any outstanding agreements, and that approval that we've already reached helped us in the process with all the remaining bargaining agreements that we have yet to negotiate or finalize. So with that, I'll just open it up and see if you have any questions, but I appreciate
Hudson,
the opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm just going to ask you to hang by. We'll get Mr. Kolonjewski's comments and any other public comments, and then we'll go to back to member questions, and they may want to visit with individuals. So just have you hang in the neighborhood, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, and welcome to the committee. So state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard Kajewski, the Public Affairs and Communications Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. This bill provision or process has come into question repeatedly these last few years. Our contract goes to a board for approval, lack of approval, or no action. The SER is that board. It may seem unique, but our contract almost always goes into effect after the legislative session. In fact, this contract expires on June 30th, as does all of our contracts of the odd year. So this legislature appropriates the money for the state agencies. Then we generally settle on a contract following the session, and then you get to decide if you like it or not. It's always been negotiated with the administration. It's a process that's worked, as Mr. Hudson said, for over 20 years. All of our state group insurance plan rates, costs, clinic levels, etc., are all the result of extensive negotiations by the state of Minnesota. All represented groups are part of a coalition bargaining process that takes a lengthy period of time, and every 2 years we bargain for that. This coverage covers over 125,000 lives. As Mr. Hudson said, we have open enrollment generally late October, early November. And Mr. Chair, this bill would require the state to change or possibly change that entire process. If you're going to try to get the contract through the following year, the even year, health care is a term and condition of employment, and we get to negotiate for that. So if a contract goes to the legislature without any action taken by the SER, it goes before the legislature. If they did make any changes to those contracts, it again has to go back to the bargaining units, and we get an opportunity to vote on those changes as well, once again. This process that you may consider unique is a process that works. It provides for open enrollment in conjunction with CGIP's negotiations process and the legislative budgeting process. Furthermore, it removes any ability to politicize the livelihoods of over 50,000 executive branch employees. Members live and spend money in all of your districts. They ensure we have clean water, monitor released offenders, work in our BCA labs to solve crime, keep up our forests, determine the sources of contaminated foods, and I could go on. I represent approximately 425 different job classes in the state of Minnesota. Many of them are unique. I think they deserve to be treated professionally and not have a contract held hostage for political trade-offs, which could happen. One time, and only under this administration with a split legislature, has our contract been rejected. Either way, whether it's because a meeting wasn't held in time, a quorum wasn't present, or a storm hit, or people just didn't feel like coming down to the Capitol for the day, this bill has the opportunity to hold up a contract for over 50,000 employees or contracts. Every agency following the budget process comes to the table, the negotiating table, and has the opportunity to weigh in on the factors and cost factors and implications to their agency. So I would ask all of you to do the right thing here today and vote no on this bill.
Is there anyone else who would like to offer testimony? We've had the two that have signed up. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to offer testimony on the matter before the committee? House File 1891, seeing none. Representative Howe and then Representative Joachim, I know you had a question for one of the specific testifiers, and we'll come back to that. Representative Howe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I to respond to some of that, you know, I was a union member for 16 years. I'm not looking to change the process. The process is a good process, except for the fact when there's a tie, the only thing that we're changing here is when it's a tie vote at the SER. And in everything we do, a tie vote fails. And I believe that should hold true here. I'm not changing the process. I think the process does work, except for the fact that when it's a tie, it should be a fail, as we do in everything else. And if that justifies going back and doing some more contract negotiations to tweak the contract to get an affirmative vote, I think that's what should be done. And I guess I'd leave it at that. I'm not looking at redefining how the SER or the contract negotiation process works, except for when the SER has a tie vote.
Representative Joachim, did you have a question? And then Representative Nelson.
Yes, to Mr. Kolodziejski. I probably totally butchered that. I'm sorry.
It's very close.
Representative Joachim, proceed with your question.
Mr. Kolodziejski, could you tell me when you negotiate the contracts, they're two-year contracts, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative, correct.
Thank you, and I appreciate. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hudson. I really appreciate you bringing in the healthcare aspect of it because that is a big deal for people to have access to their doctors and their healthcare, not to have that change midstream. I was just trying to figure out the math because I know Representative Howard mentioned some of these contracts they only have 2 months left, but the math doesn't work if they're 2 years and you come back every year. So, Mr. Kolodziejski, could you briefly you ran over a few examples of what contracts would be covered under this. Could you remind me if it's all the contracts with employees like State Patrol, all the different ones that we, this would affect all of them that we work with, right?
Mr. Chair and members, that would cover all of the collective bargaining agreements and beyond, actually, in the state of Minnesota. Some contracts have arbitration provisions, so some of them could take a significant amount more time. So that's why some of them drag out a little longer. If I could reiterate one point, this bill also, and my point in saying that this could become a political hostage, if you will, is that if there's no quorum that shows up to that meeting or people just don't, you know, there's not enough people to act on it, then there's no contract for those employees. And those employees who are working have no choice to determine that action. They can't control those. They can't force people to show up here. And they don't get to make those decisions. So I think that that's a big concern for us.
Representative Joachim? Okay. You're good? Okay. Representative Nelson, followed by Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Mr. Hudson might be able to answer this question, but what happens when the insurance. What happens if we don't approve it, if this were to be in effect, and the insurance rates goes up, who would eat that cost of the additional insurance?
Mr. Hudson.
For the employees?
Well, the negotiation process, there's a timeline to that, and we have actuarial studies on the front side of that. And we have that information based on the previous years, and we negotiate those rates, those new rates going forward. So they're set. Now, if we approve it, or if, let's say that it was tied, and we approved it for a couple of bargaining units, and we couldn't move forward with the rest because we didn't do anything with the bill. I don't know that we could go back, and we'd be in a difficult situation to do that. There's a lot of questions that, that would put us in a very unique situation, and we'd have to work with our vendors, and just a lot of unknown, uncertainty, a lot of uncertainty.
Representative Nelson, follow up.
So, Mr. Chair, and I guess this might be to Representative Howe. So, and this gets into the political football aspect of it. So we have a contract that they've gone out and say it expires June 1 of this year, and it takes 2 years to get an agreement on the contract, and it comes up for interim agreement. It goes down, which means they have no contract. It's got to go back for bargaining, before it comes to the SDR, the unions have already had their vote to say yes or no on the contract. We agree that this is what we bargained for. Now they say, no, we're not going to have what's got to be approved by the legislature. We could be in this political football where we just, because we don't want to pay people for the work that they're doing, we just won't pass the contract. We just won't pass and go on and on and on multiple years and not have contracts with our employees. I think that would be a very bad situation to be in. And I guess, Representative Howe, how would you deal with a situation like that?
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson. I don't think that changes that at all, because there's no guarantee in any of this that you're going to get an affirmative vote when you go to the SCR. And the same process, if you get a negative vote to the SCR, would happen if, under this proposal, if you had a tie vote. And that's all this does, is change a tie to a fail, as we do in every other thing in the legislature. That's all we're doing here. There's no guarantee that the SDR is going to approve every contract that comes by. So if that's what we're doing, is we're saying that we can never not have an agreement from the SDR to a contract, then why is there an SDR in place? It should just go straight to the legislature. The SCR has a vote. All we're doing in this legislation is changing a tie instead of an approval. A tie is a fail, like we do in everything else here at the legislature.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess Representative Howe and I will have to agree to disagree on this, because the way the process is now, and I think a more honest way of what you're trying to do here is make the legislature approve or disapprove of every contract. And I think the more honest way to do that, if that's what your intent is that get rid of the SCR, because then we don't have a need for it. The SCR is there so that when we're not in session and these contracts get acted upon and get negotiated, an agreement upon them, and the union agrees, has their vote and says, yes, we'll accept these conditions, whether they're wage increases, whether they're increases in what their compensation for their health care, or whether they're cuts in their health care costs, so they have to pay more, or cuts in their wages. That's what the SCR is there for, so that we can get these done and so that we can move on with our employees getting the wages that they've negotiated for. If we don't want to do that, then we should just have this, get rid of the SCR totally and bring it all back to the legislature, because I think that's what this does, is in effect, is that we could play games in the SCR, make sure people aren't there, make sure there's a tie vote, and then have it go to the legislature. Why don't we just get rid of the SCR totally and have it go to the legislature? That would be a more honest way of doing this, because this is really turning upside down, turning on its head what we do in the negotiation process and the collective bargaining process that we have. And, Mr. Chair, I oppose this legislation. I'm going to ask for a roll call on the bill.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it just feels really swampy right now. So I would like to ask the new Matt Gehring, to really kind of clarify what this bill is. Because what I hear it say is that it takes a tie vote and says, no, you got to have a majority. You got to have 51% versus 49%. That's what I hear when I read this bill, but I'm not hearing anything about that. So is that what this bill does?
Sweet.
Mr. Chair, members, Ben Weeks from House Research. So under current law, during the interim, if a collective bargaining agreement is submitted to the SCR, and The SCR then has 30 days to meet and act on it. If they don't take a vote, so if there's a non-vote, or if there's, as Representative Howe said, if there's a tie vote, anything that's not an affirmative approval, the contract goes into effect temporarily. The change in the bill means that if there's no vote at all, or if there's a tie, the contract, that's the same as a disapproval, so it's the same as an affirmative no vote by the SCR, so the contract would not go into effect. And that's the change.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just sounds like somebody's not doing their job. I mean, if you can't come to an agreement on something as important as this, I mean, I'm not getting it. So I'm probably just not getting it, but it seemed like it's a pretty simple, what I'm hearing, pretty simple bill that just isn't having any action on it.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howe, currently in state law, does the legislature have final approval over these contracts?
Representative Howe.
I believe that's to be true.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill does not change the final approval. The legislature still has final approval.
Representative Howe.
No, this does not change that. This stays the same. Legislature has final approval.
And, you know,
Joaquin,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be quick, I promise. There's been a lot of generalizations thrown out, so I'll make some of my own. What the heck? Council mentioned something interesting, which hasn't been brought up yet, and I had forgotten about it because it's been a few years since we talked about these contracts. If SCR decides not to meet, which is at the call of the chair, who's ever chairing at the time, either the Senate or the House member, which, yes, the SCR is comprised of legislators. So it's already putting out a political football at that level, because who's ever in charge of the gavel that time could decide, hey, you know what, I don't like these contracts, I don't want to call a meeting. And then folks' livelihoods are on political whims at that point. There's been some stopgaps in that, and that is the contracts going into interim approval, so games can't be played. And I think what we're missing out here is this is over 50,000 employees, folks that work in our prisons, that make sure our water's safe, that make sure our food's safe. These are real people, real lives, real families. And games can be played with their contracts by changing this law. So it's not just about whether or not a tie is a no. It also applies if that SCR decides not to meet. And that's not okay. And I've heard folks on the other side of the table and folks in this committee talk about how politics shouldn't play in people's livelihoods. That's what we're doing with this bill. And I want to just make that very clear. Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. We are a part-time legislature, and we do have to make compensations and sometimes. And my thought is, I know I will be opposing this bill because I think we owe it to our employees to provide the least amount of stress in trying to come up with the contracts. And it is, you know, in the end, again, the legislature does have to confirm the contracts.
Seeing no other member questions, I will renew my motion that House File 1891 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Requested. The clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Pugh? Bliss?
Yes.
Fenton?
Yes.
Freiberg?
No.
Halverson? Jessup?
Yes.
Lee?
No.
Mason?
No.
Nash?
Yes.
Nelson?
No.
Quam?
Yes.
Samstead?
No.
Swidzinski?
Yes.
Tice?
Yes.
West?
Yes.
Joaquim?
No.
There being 9 ayes and 6 nays, the motion does prevail. The bill is re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Representative Huff, you stay right where you're at. You have the next bill on the agenda as well, House File 1105. And I will move House File 1105 before the committee to be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Huff, to Bill 1105.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And House File 1105, what this does is make some changes to the definition of open meeting law, or the definition of meeting. And basically, all it is a couple of short lines. For the purpose of this chapter, meeting means a gathering of a quorum of, or more members of an entity covered by this section at which members discuss, decide, or receive information as a group. I will say that we've had a number of discussions. We are still working on trying to find what some people would call peace in the valley, and I will say that we'll continue to work on that, but there are some testifiers.
I do have one person signed up, Irene Cowell from the League of Minnesota Cities. If she is here and would like to proceed, we'll start with her. Again, if there are others who would like to speak on the matter before the committee, if you'll go over and see James right at the end of the walkway, he will get you signed in and queued up to be able to share your thoughts and your testimony. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Irene Gao. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. And I wanted to just express some concerns which Representative Howe is aware of. I did want to start with areas where we don't have concerns. Cities don't have concerns about the open meeting law in general. It's important for cities that meetings are open so that residents do know how cities come to their decisions. Where we do have concerns is the definition right now is pulled just partially from a Minnesota Supreme Court case. As you can see in the bill, it does say that a meeting is a gathering of a quorum of or more of members of an entity covered by the section in which the members discuss, decide, or receive information as a group. The piece that's missing is the court case then goes on to say on issues related to the official business of that entity. And the reason why that language is important is because without that, what the bill will do is it'll sweep in some things that I don't think it's meant to. One of the most important things that it'll sweep in is training. So, for example, the League of Minnesota Cities does training for newly elected officials, experienced officials. We have annual conferences where elected officials come and attend. If there is a quorum of members who come to that training, we now have to notice it, and it has to be open to the public. We want to make sure that our elected officials are as successful as possible, trained to the best extent possible, and this would then impede that. The other situation that it could inadvertently include are social gatherings. So if there's a quorum of council members that go to an American Legion meeting or happens to belong to the same church, that would this language would then include that, too. That would have to be noticed, and it would have to, and generally I would say those are probably open to the public, but you would have to then do that as well. And I understand that these are not intended by the author, but we do want to make sure that to the extent that we can, we have our elected officials trained and engaged in the communities as much as possible. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Gao. At this point, are there any other testifiers, anyone that would like to speak on the matter before? We'll have you come on down. Ms. Gao, I'll just have you stand by as we get testimony. This will most likely be the final bill that we'll be taking before the 12 o'clock break, and the committee will reconvene in room 5 at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Ms. Kelleher, if you will state your name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the School Boards Association. We represent every elected school board member from around the state. And I've had the opportunity to talk to Representative Howe, and to be honest, he's a great author to work with. But our concerns mirror the city's, only in a little bit different way. School board members, by law, have to take financial training, and we're the only local government who does that, so that everyone would get into the school van and go get the training together. Seems to make some sense, as well as some financial sense. The other thing is there's lots of things school board members do that interact with the students. Think about graduation when they're handing out diplomas. Think about choir concerts. So I've spoken to Representative Howe about this, and we're going to see if we can't get some language to let those two things occur. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Keller. And I do believe that Representative Howe said that he realizes it needs some work, and he's willing to continue working with the interested parties on that. So with that, Mr. Sewell, if you'd like to come forward, state your name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sewell. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I will echo the testimony that has just been given. The primary concern we have is, of course, 99.9% of our townships have three-member boards. So anytime two of them are together, they will automatically be a quorum. And therefore, it is very important to us to work with the author on making sure those issues of training, social gatherings, incidental contact, when two out of three will always be a quorum, we need to get that clarified more of the way the court had ruled. Thank you.
Very good. And if I remember yesterday, Mr.
Gemberling.
I was close. I was going from memory. Welcome again to the committee surface. State your name and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Don Gemberling from the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. Just quick context, and thank you, Representative Howell. I always feel like I ought to apologize to people who carry these bills for government accountability types, because what it means is their life is then surrounded by hordes of government lobbyists. That's all.
Mr. Gavick, can you get to your testimony, please, sir?
You bet.
Thank you.
A few months ago, the Department of Administration, which has the authority to issue advisory opinions about the open meeting law, issued an advisory opinion that said if the St. Paul School Board got together to discuss their process of making decisions, their goals for meeting with the administration of the St. Paul schools, and an interim plan for information sharing and decision making, that would not be a meeting within the meaning of the open meeting law. And we looked at that and we said, are you kidding me? That's what meetings are about. So in response to that, we developed a bill, which Representative Howe is carrying, and we appreciate it, right, again, to clarify what a meeting means. Now, there's lots of case law on meetings, and things like social gatherings, that sort of thing, have been deemed to be exempt either by case law or by Attorney General's opinions. And so a couple of things that just come to mind. Somebody said this would prevent training. Well, it might mean they had to give notice that they were giving training. But what's the big deal about notice these days? You put a notice on your website, you perform notice, okay? And maybe the public would like to know that people are getting training. For example, getting training on how to comply with the open meeting law, okay? And, you know, as a matter of fact, there's an interesting case in which city council members were removed because they'd been to two trainings on the open meeting law and continued to ignore it. So things like meeting the American Legion, getting together at the American Legion, I don't think those people are getting together to discuss, decide, or receive information as a group about their business as a school board. So that's why we have the bill here, because keep in mind, you probably don't know this, any governing body in this state that wants to get together and discuss the kinds of things that were discussed in the Commissioner of Administration's opinion can rely on that opinion to hold a closed meeting, and anybody who tries to sue them cannot get costs, cannot get attorney's fees, cannot receive the recompense under the provisions of the open meeting law.
Mr. Galvick, those are your final comments? Very good.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the matter before? I do want to get public testimony before we do break for those who would not be able to join us back. Mr. Sula, very quickly, because I do have some member questions, and I would like to get those, and they may involve yours and others who have testified to respond. So, Mr. Sula, very quickly.
Mr. Chair, members, maybe again, Ken Sula with Minnesota Association of Townships. Mr. Gemberling is leaving out a few key facts. When you give notice for a meeting, it is open to the public. Even if we were to create an exemption to close the meeting, it has to start as an open meeting. That means that training site is going to have to be very, very large to accommodate any member of the public that wants to come in and watch until somehow we close the meeting or whatever. It's not at all practical with the way it's set up. He cited the cases and opinions. Those are all fine and dandy until you change the statute. When you change the statute, that trumps the rulings. Because now you have to start over with the new interpretation. So just wanted to point those out. That
Mr. Sulem, thank you. I have three member questions on the list. Joachim, Nelson, and then Nash. Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick clarifying question. I don't know if it's counsel. Ms. Dyson will... I don't know if it's council that will have to take this.
Representative Joachim, I hate to interrupt you. You are very good at bringing up questions, but what I do want to do again is keep it to the testifiers if we can.
Quick question.
And we can maybe catch some of those when we reconvene, because we're probably not going to get this one done this morning.
It's just clarifying, just so I understand, and thank you for working with the with all those involved, and it sounds like you're close to an agreement. Does this include meetings that are closed for lawsuits or employee relations? I just want to clear that up.
No, that they
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You could continue to close
those. Are under a different statute.
Right.
All right, thank you. That's all I wanted.
Representative Nelson, then Representative Nash, then Representative Freiberg.
Mr. Chair, I guess my question is, where this bill's going to the floor, is what I understand.
It's going to the general register.
And I understand deadlines and everything else that's going on this week and why we're hearing so many meetings, but it sounds like there's some things that, and Representative Howells even admits that there's some things that we need to tighten up language on this. That's work that should be done in committee, and we've done we're getting a lot of these where we'll send it to the floor, general register, and then we have a promise that it'll get worked out before we hear it on the floor. I don't know. This is one that probably should be held until such time as that's worked out, because the things that need to be worked out on this are stuff that we need to do in this committee and not on the floor.
Representative Nelson, anything to the testifiers?
Mr. Chair, that's the question I have. Is this
okay? And that's more of an internal procedural question, probably for us to take up on that. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, my question. My comment is. Representative, I would ask that you continue working on this. I have experienced open meeting law. There are provisions that you post. There's provisions that you don't. But I'm all for transparency. I would ask that you keep working on it, because I have some reservations.
Representative Freiberg, you are the final one that I have on my list for member questions right now.
Thank you. Just a clarification about what Mr. Gemberling said. He said cities could just post notice on their website. Is that correct? I mean, I know a lot of times there's newspaper publication requirements, too, which can get pretty expensive, especially for cities and townships.
Representative Freiberg, I'm going to ask Mr. Weeks, but I bet you I know the answer he's going to give on that, and that is you have to post via the adopted method of either posting online in the newspaper, depending upon what is covered by statute, as well as your regular meeting notice posts and those kinds of things. That's been my experience in local government, but I will defer to, I'm sorry, Ms. Dyson. Look at that.
Mr. Chair, we're very good at
you
speaking.
Are.
And, I think, Mr. Chair, you're correct. It depend, the notice is governed by statute, and it will be, it's not just on the web.
Okay, so it could be costly, I guess, is my point.
Or there could be no cost at all, depending upon what the city's adopted as their methods of posting. Other member questions? Again, maybe we can finish this up before we process. Representative Freiber.
Okay, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure if we were coming back to discuss this more, because I do. I appreciate what you're doing, because I have been on. I was spent 9 years on a city council, and what constitutes a meeting is. You know, it was always a big question for us, and we were never totally certain. So I think, to the extent you can clarify it without having side effects of doing so, I think that's good. I mean, I guess one other question I have maybe for Ms. Dyson is, it says a meeting means a gathering of a quorum or more members of an entity covered by this section. So when I see the word gathering, I think of a physical gathering. I mean, one of the questions we would have when I was on the city council is if multiple people are posting things on Facebook in response to a group, then have we inadvertently created a meeting there, since we're sort of discussing things? Does this mean, would this change? I mean, yeah, I heard Representative Nash say that would be a serial meeting. That's correct. But as Mr. Sulem pointed out, we're changing the definition here. A serial meeting, I believe, was a term determined in a court decision. So if we redefine a meeting,
said what the council can help us, should we just ask it?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, so, I mean, I assume this would change, maybe get rid of the court decisions that have been in place about serial meetings, and then maybe it would clear it up in a sense, just because a meeting would no longer be, if it is a physical gathering, then a meeting would no longer be posted on a Facebook or social media. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, I'm not sure that it would change some of the things you're talking about, serial meetings and others. Physical gathering, the statute, once you have determined you have a meeting, the statute says you can have, under certain circumstances and for certain groups, they can meet by interactive televisions, you know, electronic means. There is a statute that was enacted a few years ago relating to use of social media. There's going to be an interaction between this and all of those other provisions, and I'm not sure. I think the agencies that have been looking at this may have some additional comments, but looks like they do.
Ms. Gall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, what I just read you is from the Minnesota Supreme Court, so it's already law now. So this would modify our understanding of it, but everything else in terms of serial meetings or anything else would still apply. It's just with the absence of the phrase that I had mentioned, that's what changes.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's some questions. The question I have for Representative Hall, do you think you could, between now and 3 o'clock, get that language talked about, worked out, so that we're not sending an incomplete bill to the floor? And if so, can we then hold this over and bring it back at 3 o'clock?
Well, let's ask Representative Hall what his timeline looks like. Representative Hall.
I've got no guarantees that we can come to an agreement by 3 o'clock. I mean, we will continue to work on this, but we've got some folks that have to contact their legal folks to work on this. I give you my word that when this thing, even if we send this to the General Registry, I will have an amendment to get this right for everybody involved.
Or we won't hear it.
It won't come to the House floor unless it's right.
Representative Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chair, seeing as how we're at past our noon drop deadline, why don't we hold this over till this afternoon and give them the opportunity. And if they don't have something, if they can't get it worked out, I would waive any 24-hour rule that we have if they can come up with language between now and 3 o'clock. And if not, we'll send it on to the floor, and I'll hold Representative Howell, and I think we should all hold Representative Howell to his promise to not move it forward until we have a...
So, Representative Nelson, I think I'm okay with that as long as we've had our debate so that if they don't have anything, they come back, that we can just take it to a vote. I'm happy with that. I would really not want to revisit the stuff that we've had the questions on from this morning for this afternoon. Does that seem agreeable to you?
That seems agreeable to me. The only caveat there would be the open meeting law, if we can get some what the law says about notice, because of my understanding of notice, whatever their official notice is, it does have to be printed in a newspaper also. So, I mean, this could affect that. And, again, it was raised a lot of cost for local counties and cities and townships.
So with that, we will recess until 3 o'clock, and we'll reconvene at that time in room 5 or to the call of the chair if there is a need to do that. We are recessed until 3 p.m. or the call of the chair. I will call back to order the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee for Thursday, March the 9th. And as they say in daytime soap operas, when we last left our previous episode, we had a situation where Representative Howe was given an assignment by the committee to go out and see if in 3 hours he could make the world a better place for everyone. And he is now ready to report on his assignment. Representative Howe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but it was only 2 hours, and otherwise it was a rather quick. Well, I guess maybe it was 3 hours a little bit, but it felt like an hour and a half. but we time flew by. We realized that you don't make good policy fast. So our we have committed to basically continue to work on an amendment that we'll bring to the floor. We have everybody's agreed that I believe we can get this thing done. So that's what we intend to do.
Well, and again, our understanding was that we would move it out of committee, you would continue to work with it, and that if it's not to everyone's liking, that we would leave it sit there until it was people's liking, and if the clock ran out, we'd work with it next year.
And you'll see me back here to this committee next session, if that's what the way it works out.
Well, we appreciate the forewarning, Representative Holland. With that, as the report on the assignment, I will renew my motion that House File 1105 be referred to the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. You are on your way, Representative Howe. The next bill that we have on the agenda this afternoon is House File 33. Representative Johnson, as you are making your way to the testifiers' table, I am going to move House File 33 to be re-referred to the general register. And with that, Representative Johnson, I'm going to ask you to chair your bill with the committee. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill deals with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Currently, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission is set up. When they make a ruling or change anything, it goes into effect unless the legislature says no. There's about approximately 14 states that have Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and it's a toss-up, about 50-50. Some say it goes to the legislature first before they go into effect for approval, and some say it's the system that we have. I'm in the belief that any changes should be done by the legislature and have their approval before they go into effect. Right now, there's 11 members of that board, and when the board was started in 1978, and the law authorized them, there was 9 members, and they've grown since then. And all the changes that I've been able to find to the Sentencing Guidelines Committee has been done through the agency bill. With 11 members, they need 6 members for a quorum, and 4 members can drastically change the sentencing guidelines for the sentencing part is the amount of time that a person is incarcerated in one of the state prisons. Now, we have 202 elected officials that are supposed to make that decision. We have to have 68 House members vote. We have to have 34 senators vote, and a governor sign it to make it law. And for me, I think it's important that when we discuss these things, that they're out in the open, out in the public, getting public input. Does the Sentencing Guidelines Committee have that? Yes. But even in the Public Safety Committee, there was only one, when I asked, there had only been one member that are, besides myself, that had been to a Sentencing Guidelines meeting. There's not many people that go to them. They're not covered by the press. So I believe it's important that when we make these decisions, it's more open and more discussion, and we think it out thoroughly with more public input. And that is the essence of the bill.
Representative Johnson, do you have any testifiers on your bill today?
I did not bring any testifiers with me today.
All right. I will ask if there's anyone present today that would like to speak on the matter that's before the committee at this time, House File 33. Good afternoon. Come on down.
Good.
Welcome, and we'll have you introduce yourself and state who you represent, if you do represent a group, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Kelly Mitchell, and I am the Executive Director of the Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice at the University of Minnesota. Prior to taking that position, I was the Executive Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. If I can proceed. Minnesota was the first state in the nation to enact sentencing guidelines, and our guidelines are viewed as a model both within the United States and internationally. The guidelines bring stability and predictability to our system and allows our state to prioritize prison resources for those who commit the most serious offenses or who have the most extensive criminal records. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission was established as an independent agency, and this is where it comes under your purview. It comprises representation from all of the stakeholders in the criminal justice systems. The members include judges, prosecution, defense, probation, corrections, law enforcement, victims, and the public. They meet on a monthly basis, and their role is to serve as our state's source of expertise on sentencing policy and practice. The commission reviews and amends the guidelines on an annual basis, and every single one of those amendments is presented to the legislature in the form of an annual report. If the legislature is dissatisfied with the changes, it can enact a law. And when it enacts that law, it can do a full range of activities. It can block the change from taking effect, can delay the effective date of a change. It can direct the commission to do more work on the proposal, or it can modify the proposal directly. The oversight by the legislature is referred to as the legislative override. If the commission develops proposals, if the legislature takes no actions, those proposals will take effect. But if it so chooses, the legislature can override that proposal in one of the ways that I just mentioned. Representative Johnson told you, Minnesota is one of eight jurisdictions that utilize legislative override. The seven states that require affirmative legislative approval have actually enacted the sentencing guidelines into their statutes. Most of the seven states that require legislative approval have enacted the guidelines into their statutes. So by necessity, any change to those guidelines has to go through the legislature, but that's not the system that we have created here. Instead, we have chosen to delegate that expertise to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And there's a couple of benefits to doing that. One of those is that the legislature can rely on the expertise of the commission. The commission conducts research. It vets controversial issues through public hearings, which it does hold. And all of this reduces the amount of time that the legislature has to spend on these issues, requiring legislative approval, in contrast, would shift all of that work to the legislature. So the override approach allows the legislature to focus only on those sentencing policy issues that are the most concerning to it and doesn't clog up the session with the regular housekeeping work of the commission, the regular housekeeping business. It's been argued that this bill is needed because some of the cases that we read about in the newspaper demonstrate that the commission isn't doing its job. But we have to remember that the role of the legislature and the role of the commission are very different. The legislature defines crimes and establishes the maximum penalties for those crimes. Sometimes egregious crimes drive the work of the legislature and result in increased maximum punishments so that we can be confident that the law allows for appropriately harsh sentences in those cases. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission, in contrast, rather than dealing with those extreme cases, is tasked with establishing the framework for sentencing based on the typical case. And we want this to be their focus because that represents the majority of the cases that go through our criminal justice system, not the extremes at either end. The court has the ability to deal with those. That said, when the legislature does increase the maximum penalties, the commission will generally respond by re-ranking the severity level of those offenses so that they will be subject to harsher penalties. In the past 10 years, there's only been three instances where the legislature felt that they needed to exercise their override power. So in 7 out of 10 years, the legislature did not have to spend its precious time on sentencing issues. And in the 3 years where they felt like there was an issue that they wanted to address, they exercised their authority, and they did appropriately change the proposals of the commission. The Minnesota guidelines have been in operation for over 30 years. The legislative override has been a feature of the guidelines since its inception. Legislative override helps to keep the politics out of sentencing policy and benefits the legislature by requiring the body only to weigh in on the issues that are the most important to it. Given the long and established history of the guidelines and of the relationship between the commission and the legislature, there's simply no reason to change the system to require affirmative approval. The system is working as it was designed to. It isn't broken, and so I urge you not to fix it.
Ms. Mitchell, thank you for your testimony today. Members, any questions of Ms. Mitchell at this time? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Mitchell. You said the commission generally will respond, and that troubles me because sentencing guidelines are not trivial, and the power and authority comes from the legislature. What this bill does is to have it an affirmative instead of autopilot. And frankly, the responsibility lies with the legislature. And I see no reason why the legislature should not stand up to that responsibility. It doesn't take away anything from the commission. It just has it go through, and the legislature will get a bill with the commission's recommendation, and it'll go through the process. And then we can agree. But it does trouble me when we grant the power down to another entity to hear the phrase, the commission generally will respond to the wishes of the legislature. I don't think that's the way it should be structured, and I fully support this bill. I'm not sure if I've got a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Joaquin, question for the testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the testifier. Maybe you can clarify. I'm not sure I'm tracking with what Representative Quam said. I know that the legislative override demands that you listen to the legislature. So could you clarify that maybe?
Ms. Mitchell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Joaquin, yes, there's actually two issues tied up together here. So number one, when the legislature exercises their override authority and changes a proposal that the commission submitted, that change goes into effect. That's what happens. The change is made. In response to the comment about the commission generally responding, when I say generally responding by re-ranking a crime, the reason I say it that way is because sometimes the commission is even more creative than that. For instance, when the DWI felony law was passed, rather than putting that in a particular place on the grid, the commission determined that an entirely new row on the grid was necessary. So re-ranking a crime isn't always the right crime or the right response to affect the intent of the legislature. Sometimes the commission gets more creative than that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other? Ms. Mitchell, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mitchell, I appreciate your words, but this would be kind of it really seems like this bill moves kind of on the pocket. It gives you an opportunity. The legislature must, rather than the legislature not do something, it actually asks folks that are elected to take action on this, whether or not something should move forward or not. And I think that's a positive move with this. I think it better fits with other areas of the legislature and with actions taken. If the governor decides he doesn't like a bill, he can either veto it, which would be taking action, or do nothing, which would also veto it. And I think that's an important step that this bill takes.
I didn't hear a question. It was more of a statement. At this time, I don't have any other member questions. Ms. Mitchell. Oh, Representative Joaquin wants to follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have questions for the author more than Ms. Mitchell.
Yeah, so let's maybe work through some of the other public testimony. If there is anyone who would like to speak to the matter before. Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Yes. Anyone who would like to speak on the matter before the commission, or before the committee, excuse me, on House File 33? Seeing none, we will go to member questions again for the author. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, do you know, are you familiar with indeterminate sentencing?
Representative Johnson.
A little bit familiar with that.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I only bring that up is because indeterminate sentencing was one of the reasons why the Guidelines Commission was created in 1978. Back then, what they were seeing across the state was a real unequal justice. You could commit a crime in one county or one city and get charged one time for a length of time. You could go somewhere else and have a drastically either reduced or drastically increased sentence. So sentencing guidelines' first task was to sit down and look at all those departures and see where there was these windows. And if you've ever seen the grid, it has the crimes on the left side and then criminal scores across the top, and your criminal score goes up. And you can kind of guess, and I'm not going to go into that because it's out of our jurisdiction a little bit. But where I'm going with this and trying to explain is that we task the experts with that, the experts that are judges, the folks that work in the criminal justice system, the folks that live and breathe this every day, people that are experts that do it every day, not us, a part-time legislature. And the more bills I see go through, that's kind of pushing us to a full-time legislature. And I'm just wondering what problem are you really trying to fix? Because there's only been three cases where the legislature has deemed the guidelines not to be accurate and has stepped in, and that has been changed. So it seems like it's working. So what part are you seeing that needs to be changed?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Overall, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, they've done very well. They've done good at fixing the disparity gap that we had in the sentences. But we still have some problems where judges, I think, are doing downward departures too often. And we have, if you actually take a list of the departures, it's consistently with the same judges. But that's another issue that sentencing guidelines cannot really do too much on. Part of the issue is all our commissions. All our commissions that we have, we rely on experts to get the information to the legislature. Why is this commission any different than any other? I'm not sure. But all the commissions that we have put together, it's put together with lists of experts, whether it's in Health and Human Services, whether it's in transportation. We have experts to deal with this. They bring that information to the legislature for us to make a decision to do the best decision that's what's best for the state and also all the citizens of Minnesota.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, what was your position on the sentencing guidelines proposed changes last year on drug sentencing?
Representative
My own personal opinion was the changes that they proposed went way too far. My sheriff describes the compromise that Representative Cornish worked on very diligently until the end of session until we got something through. My sheriff described it as, it probably is a good compromise because everybody hates it. The defense attorneys hated it. The prosecution hated it. Law enforcement hated it. So maybe that was a good compromise. I can tell you this, the decisions, what sentencing guidelines originally proposed went a lot farther than that compromise did. But that compromise that we did removed people out of the state prison system that could have got treatment programs for drug offenses that are now sitting in county jails not getting any treatment programs. In talking with my county attorney, they're seeing an increase in cases going to court because instead of pleading guilty to the felony drug offense, they're going to court and trying to prove the burglary. So it's jamming up the court system. And it's a tool that the prosecutors were able to use to give a person a crime that's considered victimless, a drug offense, which in my opinion is far from victimless because I've never done a search warrant for drugs without finding stolen property. I've never done a search warrant for stolen property without finding drugs. They're related. But so it's what happened with that. If we got to that compromise that Representative Cornish put together, it would have gone farther than what it was, and I think it would hurt Minnesota, the safety of Minnesota even farther.
Mr.
Representative Nelson.
I had to follow up on that compromise.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had made a statement about it's important to get people treatment, and I absolutely agree, but wouldn't it be cheaper to have these people getting the treatment in their community than having them in prisons? It costs a lot of money to keep people in prisons.
Representative Mason, was that a question or a statement?
Yes. My thought is, isn't it more efficient and certainly cheaper to get the treatment people need in the community rather than putting them in prison.
Representative Johnson, do you want to briefly address that?
Yeah, sometimes it is cheaper, sometimes it's not. When you get on some of the cocaine and heroin, they have to be off the stuff for 6 to 8 months, and it's inpatient treatment 6 to 8 months, which could be done in the prison system, and not on top of that in an outpatient or in an inpatient treatment such as Hazleton. So it's either way, it's very expensive. But I think getting them, if we can do that in the prison system, especially with those hard drugs, we can have a better opportunity. What they found out is those that participate in the drug treatment program, there's a 20% reduction in the recidivism rate. But unfortunately, and I would like to get some more money into the treatment program, into the prison system, but before they can even be eligible for the treatment, they have to be in 3, 4, 5 times. And that's too far. I would like to see the treatment program hit the first time they're in prison, so we have a possibility of them not going in 3, 4, 5 times. But at the county level, I actually have a bill that I drafted, and it's waiting for a hearing for grant programs to help with the local communities to do the drug treatment programs, because now they're not going into the prison system. Now they're at the local level, and it's putting the costs on the local level instead of at the state level.
Representative Joachim, coming back to you, I do want to make sure that everybody gets a chance. I know that you but I want to make sure that all members get a chance to have their questions
heard. I completely understand, Mr. Chair, and I wanted to bring us back to the bill a little bit, because these are great policy discussions that we could be having, but right now we're talking about the sentencing guidelines grid, and that grid allows for some flexibility at the local with the judge, because it just creates bookends on the lowest end and the highest end you can charge people. And so that flexibility and judicial discretion is there. My point with the asking about the compromise that you mentioned, do you remember what the vote was in the House on that compromise?
Representative Johnson.
I don't remember completely, but I know it was almost unanimous, if I remember correctly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative
Johnson. Representative Joachim, are we coming close to the end of questions? Okay, just checking.
It was unanimous, and that's when what the system we have in place works. The legislature felt, and I think I would agree with you, that what the sentencing guidelines originally proposed was maybe went a little bit too far. The legislature saw that. They used their override. They went in. They put a statute in place and fixed it. I worry about us spending time up here doing things that experts can take care of and task force that have been working for 30 years just fine, and stepping in and making us almost a full-time legislature dealing with things that the other branches of government are fairly capable of. We have a judicial branch. That's what they're there for. And I feel like we keep stepping into other people's territories on this. And I think the system's working just fine, and the judicial and the legislative override is working just fine, and I'm sorry I'm going to have to oppose your bill, and I would strongly suggest other people would too, because this really tips on top of the head a system that's been working well to make sure that there's equal justice for all across our state. And thank you.
Seeing no other member questions and there are no other public testimony, Representative Johnson, I will renew my motion that House File 33 be referred to the General Register. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. It is going to the General Register. As Representative Loon makes her way down from House File 1958, Representative Freiberg, have you had a chance to review the minutes that were in our packets this afternoon?
Yes, I did, and I would move approval.
Representative Freiberg moves the approval of the March 8th minutes from the Government Operations and Elections Committee. Any corrections or changes? Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Representative Loon, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1958 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Representative Loon, if you will proceed with your bill presentation.
Yes, and actually, Mr. Chair, if you wouldn't mind, the bill does need to be seen by State Government Finance. I conferred with the chair, and so if you could direct it there.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. We were originally told it was an Ed 5. It was going to your committee, but we're happy to put it where you feel you need to have it go. So with that, I will revise my motion that House File 1958 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And some concerns have been raised to me that because of lines 3.15 and 3.16, that this also needs to go to HHS reform. Because it says, my tongue out of the way here. The Commissioner of Human Services.
What's that?
How do you spell that? I'll have to get back to you on that. The Commissioner of Human Services must administer the quality rating improvement system. So doesn't this have to go there for them? And that being a policy committee, if we send it to finance and it doesn't get back, they're going to kill it so it doesn't make deadlines.
Representative Nelson, you raised a very good question. I have been advised that the chair of Health and Human Services Policy has been asked and has declined to hear this bill, and that's why it's to us right now. And so it can go as the bill author, Chair Loon, wants it to go to State Government Finance.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could address the point that Representative Nelson made, The Department of Human Services currently administers the quality rating system, so that's just basically a statement that it would continue to administer that program. So it's not a change in current practice.
Okay. So with that, again, House File 1958 to be re-referred, move House File 1958 to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Now we are ready to hear from you, Representative Loon, on the genesis of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am pleased to provide this bill for you and had an opportunity to talk about it in Education Policy Committee this morning. I've been a proud supporter of early education programs and providing opportunities for those children who are born into families where they may be at economic disadvantage or disadvantaged in other ways, that they tend to fall into the achievement or the opportunity gap. And early childhood education of a high-quality nature is one of the many tools that we know can help bring children to the level of being ready to learn when they're entering into kindergarten. And we know that from research that children entering into kindergarten on par with their peers stand a better chance of being able to read at grade level at third grade, and then are positioned for success in their educational career and hopefully graduate from high school. So as we have grown early childhood programs, early childhood and development programs through various streams and programs that we have, we are now at a point where we have sort of a good situation, but one where we need to take a look at how we're coordinating all of these various programs. And they do cross a number of agencies within our state government. As the chair of the Education Finance Committee, I oversee some of these programs, the Early Education Scholarship Program, Pathway 1 and 2, School Readiness. There's a voluntary pre-K program. As Representative Nelson raised, the quality rating system, which accompanies those programs, specifically the scholarship programs, is housed under the Department of Human Services. We also have some other programs in Human Services and the CCAP program, and all of which affect young children and their families. And so with about $400 million a year being appropriated and spent by the taxpayers in those programs, I think we've reached a point where we really need a director and a position within state government that oversees and coordinates those programs so that we can ensure we're making the most efficient and effective use of these dollars, that we are reaching all of the families who need this assistance, and that we are providing it in a thoughtful way. So that, in a nutshell, is the bill. I would be happy to either have testifiers on it or to respond to committee questions at this time, whatever would be your preference.
Representative Chair Loon, did you have any other testifiers on your? Because I do have some that have signed up that want to speak, but I just wonder if you have any testifiers that you wanted at this time.
Ms. Moss, if she would like to speak to the bill, that would be great.
Okay. Do you would like to state your name, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Erica Moss, and I'm the executive director of an organization called Close Gaps by Five. We're part of about now a 10-year effort of work on early education, advancing early education in particular for low-income children, moving the system more to a quality system that serves kids well. And we work in and around this variety of funding streams that Representative Loon mentioned. And I would like to thank Chair Loon for bringing this bill forward because I think it addresses concern that we hear from folks in your position as we do our job of advocates around the Capitol. And the what we hear is questions that are difficult to answer. For example, how many low-income children currently receive public funding in support of their early education? How many receive that from multiple funding sources? Which ones? How many hours? What are the outcomes? And we feel like the time is right. As Representative Loon mentioned, this system has kind of grown up through this variety of funding streams. This bill doesn't do anything to any of those individual funding streams, but it seeks to create a director position to coordinate them at the state level, and that coordination is going to allow the programs to work together more accountably and efficiently, and will also allow cross-agency coordination that's been difficult to get off the ground. So I'm here today happy to support the proposal and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And seeing no member questions at this time, I'm going to go to the testifiers who have signed up in advance. And the first testifier I have is Greg Great and then Val Dosslyn. So if you would like to get yourselves queued up, and then following that will be Amity Foster. It's great. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Craig Grotke, and I represent the Minnesota Head Start Association. I'm the president of the association, but I also operate a Head Start, Early Head Start program, seven counties in east central Minnesota. And so we have Gail, who is the executive person of our Head Start Association, has met with Ms. Loon and had discussions and a number of things, but we still have some concerns about this bill. And so what I would say is in our program, we serve families in about a 6,100 square mile service area. We do that in center-based programs, home-based programs. We have a number of partnerships in schools that have layered funding. I mean, we're there. School districts are doing layered funding, but all of that goes to serve children full day. We also have partnerships with family child care providers where funding streams are blended. And we have partnerships with center care providers where we braid and blend a lot of funding to serve kids full day, full year. And so we understand in the field that all of that's very necessary. Some of the other things that we do is we partner with homeless shelters, and we provide very specific programming with homeless shelters that's allowed under our Head Start innovative side. And so we have some leeway with Head Start state funding to do innovative things. And so we provide a myriad of services to homeless families in that kind of setting. And kind of where our concerns are around this bill is moving basically the funding out of two departments into a new department, and a department of administration that has not operated these types of programs historically. We're worried about the loss of institutional knowledge and history. We're worried about that creating disruptions, maybe some short-term disruptions of services, but also the consolidation of this may have some long-term impacts that we're just not aware of yet. We haven't had a lot of time to sit down and deal with this. The other thing is that the Department of Education is still going to maintain some programs. They're still going to have early childhood family ed. They're going to operate Title I. They're going to operate early childhood special ed. We're seeing this as if there's another layer of admin, that money is going to be trapped at this first admin level. It'll come through MDE. There'll be money taken off there, and we won't be able to serve the same number of kids on the ground in local communities. That's an issue that we have. I think the other Well, I think there's coordination issues because of the two programs still operating, various options. We do agree that coordination is important. I would say that we think that both at the department level and on the ground, that is an important thing. I can say that we work with 27 different school districts. I have memorandums of understanding with 27 school districts and a handful of special ed co-ops. And so we partner on the ground. It's not that we're not communicating. Things are happening locally. I would reiterate our concern about potential moves and the reduction of services and resources to families, and that the children using the programs are at high risk. We're not talking about middle-income or upper-income kids. We're talking about kids living in poverty. That's what the focus of these funding streams are. And they represent a group that has the greatest achievement gap, which really needs to be addressed if we want to move Minnesota forward. And we want to be a leader in education in the country. We need to address that. It's a huge issue for us. I've been in this work for over 20 years, working with families both in school districts and child care, and for a long time now in Head Start and Early Head Start. And so I understand all of the nuances of this and what happens on the ground and how families need multiple levels of resources to get what they need. And it's not so much that you look at it as one family getting more or one family getting less. It's that looking at it as targeted and looking at services that this family needs this much intervention, and this is what we have to pay for. And so I would just, please, just we need to think about this bill before it moves forward.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Members, any questions of the testifier? Thank you again. Next, I think we have Amity Foster. Ms. Goslin. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name and tell us who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslin. I represent the Minnesota Community Education Association. I'd like to thank Representative Loon for her for her commitment to work with us on some of the concerns that we raise. MCA shares Representative Loon's and many people in this room and supporters in the audience their commitment to serve at-risk kids in early learning programs. We share their commitment to make sure services are coordinated and that at-risk families are getting the services that they need and that the public understands where the resources are being used. We do question why some of the early learning programs need to be moved out of the Department of Education under the Department of Administration. Don't have an understanding for what anyone, not to disrespect the Department of Administration, I'm sure they're experts in what they do, but I don't understand what expertise or experience staff in the Department of Administration have in early learning programs. And then also I would just like to reiterate what Mr. Gratke said. You know, there's a number of different things that early learning programs coordinate. It's not just the items that are listed in the bill, but there's also early childhood screening. There's also early childhood family education, early childhood special ed, various Title I programs, and various ELL programs. And we are concerned that there might be a disconnect if those are separated. Also, I just would like to point out that this bill does not include moving the Child Care Assistance Program from DHS or home visiting. And I think in order to have the biggest picture in what we need to do to coordinate and streamline, we have to have all those and activities included under a proposal. So, again, I want to thank Representative Loon. She's always been available when I've reached out to her to ask questions and always available and is working with us to try to address our concerns. And we'll continue to do that as we try to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, questions for the testifier? Seeing none, thank you so much. And now we will move on to Amity Foster. If you are here, Amity Foster. Okay, we will then move on to, forgive me for, I can't read the chair's handwriting, Galicia Hermita. And I may have just horribly butchered your name, so forgive me if I did so. But as you're coming down, as you get there, if you would give your name for the record and whom you represent.
Hola, mi nombre es Gelasia Ermita. Y yo tengo una preocupación. Gestar me dio la oportunidad de tener a mi hija en tiempo completo, pero a la vez estar agarrando entrenamientos. Quisiera saber qué va a pasar ahora. Tengo la oportunidad de hacer alguien mejor en la vida, pero si quitan estos movimientos, no sé qué va a pasar.
Hi, my name is Claudia Escudero. I'm a family advocate for PICA Head Start, and I'm here with Fiscalicia. And her concerns, what she just spoke, is regarding about the movements that's going to be changing for full-day programs, all the funding that we have for our parents and children. Right now, she mentioned that her daughter is in a full-day program, and she has the opportunity to participate in training to get better life for herself. Also, she's taking ESL classes right now. A little nervous, that's why she didn't speak the language. So she, her concern is what's going to happen if they move things around. She had to, she's going to have the opportunity to choose where to go, or go to daycare, or go do trainings. And in this moment, she's doing both, thanks to the programs of Head Start.
Thank you. Any other comments that you wish to continue? Is that all?
One of the comments and expressions on the program, as an advocate, I would like to continue the system that it is for our program, because we can serve a lot of families, color families, Hispanic families, low-income families, and we support in many, many areas, medical, we do early interventions, dental, so we can help families to grow and learn in this country, especially the immigrants that come to the United States, who can provide and educate the way our system works for the families, and they can help the children in the future. So I think that we should continue the way it is at this time, and don't make drastic changes for us, or no changes at all, because it's going to affect a lot of families, and especially our children. So please consider our petition here. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for your testimony. Again, I'll ask members questions. Seeing none, thank you so much. I have nobody else on the list. Are there other members of the public that wish to testify? Okay, we'll move on to member questions for the author. Members, Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loon. I guess I'm trying to get my head around this bill, what we're doing here. It sounds like we're taking multiple programs that are in separate agencies, bringing them all into admin, bringing the money sources that go with them into one program or one division or whatever we want to call this. And is that what I'm hearing this bill does?
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson. Yes, the proposal is to take these various programs. It does not change the requirements of each individual program. It does not affect the funding levels for any of those programs, but it would put the coordination and the oversight of the delivery of these programs under a director of, I'm trying to remember what we called it, early education and development. Because we have, as described, families with maybe multiple needs, we have allowed our funding streams, in many cases for early education, to be braided or be combined. But we don't have good information or data about which children we're serving, how many programs they may be accessing for their services, what maybe is that meeting their needs, is it not meeting their needs, what is the result of that, what is the most successful braiding of these funding streams, and how best to use it. And again, as I mentioned before, with the level of funding that I think we've devoted to it, and rightly so, we need to be able to answer some of those questions and have some of that data. But unfortunately, with programs in various agencies, we have made attempts at trying to coordinate those and have the agencies work more closely together. But, you know, we're not there yet. And so this bill is really an attempt to have a person, a director who's responsible for that, for gathering that research, for having that information, to making sure that the information of what's available to families as well is out. I forgot to mention that this would also have the creation of hubs out across the state, so families could go sort of one-stop shopping to get access to knowing what's available in their communities for services. And, you know, the Department of Administration is sort of a neutral spot for this director because we've got people, again, in education, in human services, perhaps in the Department of Health. So it's an attempt to try to provide better coordination and through that also better data so we know what outcomes we're getting for the investments that we're making.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the concern I have, we're dealing, you're saying it's multiple different agencies, it's not just education, but this is mostly dealing with education, early childhood development, that might be better in education department. But the concern I have is that by bringing all these funding streams together, and even though they're for specific programs, that money could be siphoned off or grabbed from one program to used in another program in ways that it's not in, that we don't have, it hasn't been intended and the funding isn't for. So I have some concerns about this. I think the overall idea of coordinating these makes some sense, but I still have some concerns about the way this is being done at this time.
Chair Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. And I know some concerns or worry has been raised in some of the testifiers, and I just want to assure the members I've had a lengthy meeting with some of the affected early childhood program delivery services. We did amend the bill. That's actually a clone bill that was heard in education policy today to help meet deadlines, and I did offer an amendment to address some of those concerns, and we'll continue working to make this something that is can be embraced by everyone. I have been very pleased, I must say, by the bipartisan support I've received already for the bill, and will continue to work to address any concerns. I wanted to raise one other point. Someone mentioned CCAP and why not that, or that was another program within HHS's jurisdiction. There is a study commissioned within the bill to look at that and the feasibility of moving CCAP under this director's authority as well. Again, you can braid CCAP and scholarship money and school readiness and other resources here for early childhood. But we do have a study first to look at that, but that would not happen without further legislative action.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you again, Chair Loon. I had the opportunity to be a part of the discussion earlier this morning in the Education Policy Committee, and we have heard from many of the departments or service providers, but throughout the day before coming to the committee, this committee, a lot of community members have reached out to me, and I just wanted to ask you, have you reached out to get some of the community inputs? And one of the points that was made earlier today was so that if we do go this route, that we don't have any unintended consequences that will impact our communities, and especially right now in the state of Minnesota with what's going on regarding racial disparity, that we're not impacting our communities of color.
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Representative Lee, and I really do appreciate the question. Yes, I've had meetings with Head Start, representatives from Head Start, both the state director and one of the providers locally in Hennepin area, school representatives of school districts, of community education, our rural education association representatives, and I will continue. We're going to continue meeting with people tomorrow into next week. The bill has a couple more committee stops, so we have ample opportunity, I think, to make sure that we're reaching out to all affected parties. And with regards to concerns of racial minorities and affected persons within various communities. I'm very mindful of that. That's been a point that's been brought up. And I think for that reason is one of the primary purposes of bringing this forward. I do think, again, as we have someone who's overseeing the service that we're providing, how we're doing it, and in the various communities with a hub that's responsible for reaching out to families in their individual communities, we will see a much more coordinated and a much more effective approach of how we support families with young children in poverty and providing them the support that they need to be successful.
Okay. Member questions? Representative Sandsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually am looking at an email I just received from a constituent who's got some concerns about this. Does your bill place all of the funds as you create this pool, if you will, or this oversight? Does it create a fund that pools all the money?
Chair Loon.
From the programs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandsteed, yes, it does.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sandsteed.
Thank you. For children that are participating in, like, the federal Head Start program, does this eliminate positions or slots?
Chair Loon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sandsteed, no, I would not anticipate that it would eliminate position or slots.
Representative Sandsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This individual is concerned that based on the 75th percentile for the child care market rate, up to like 2,400 slots could be eliminated.
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sandsteed. I think with the concern that's being raised by your constituent has to do with language in the bill that addresses a cap for spending per child. And so, as I mentioned, we have a number of funding programs and funding streams that may be braided or coordinated. So a family getting service may have CCAP dollars, they may have scholarship dollars, they may be getting service through some school readiness or VPK money or Head Start. But we don't know a child that's in a program, we don't know necessarily how many funding streams are being combined and what the overall investment is in providing that child and that family what they need. In order to try to have a look at that and try to make sure that our resources are reaching as many families in poverty as possible, the bill proposes a cap at 75% of the market rate, and this is a market rate survey of child care that's done by DHS every 2 years. And in response to the concerns that were raised on the cap language in the bill, the amendment that I offered in education policy this morning and will be when these bills are merged back together, would push that out into 2019 so we can have more research into that and continue to look at that concern.
And members, I'm going to interject here. I was consulting with Mr. Gehring, and this particular line of questioning is now outside of the purview of this committee. We're not a finance committee, and it is more appropriately in ed finance. So super valid questions. Perhaps we can take that offline. Just want to make sure that we stay within the bounds of where we belong. Representative Sandsted, any questions for the germaneness of the committee?
Yes, actually.
Representative Sandsted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be possible that this could create a situation where maybe the metro area would be served stronger than Greater Minnesota, or perhaps participants in Greater Minnesota would be forced to make a choice between either like part-time Head Start programs or child care?
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sandsteed. Well, I think one of the reasons for doing the research, and again was part of the amendment, and I'll ask Ms. Moss to address this as well, is to look at, maybe what that information from the current market rate survey is showing and how there may be disparities in what is required depending on where you are in Minnesota for delivering the high-quality services that are needed and what the resources are available. So I think that's a valid question. Just to share for the committee, one of the questions that came up with regards to this line of discussion this morning was, what is that, what would that cap be? And right now, and again, this is for Hennepin and Ramsey County, 75% of the market rate would be, I'm going to round it, just it's about $14,000 per child. But again, because we don't know with the braiding of the funding streams how much we're spending per child, and is that enough? Is it not enough? You know, those are things that we can't answer. And when we don't have the kind of data that we need to answer those questions, it concerns me, and probably all legislators as being responsible for taxpayer dollars, why don't we know that when we're spending, again, hundreds of millions of dollars every year? And if we don't know exactly where it's going, how it's going, and what the outcomes are, those are questions that we need to answer, and I think we need a person responsible for having that information, and that's what I'm proposing to do through this director position. And if Ms. Moss has anything to add to that.
Ms. Moss, because we're being taped, if you'd reintroduce yourself for the tape.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, I would say, first of all, there was the amendment this morning that allows for more research. And I think this is exactly why we need this coordination. The number that's in the bill, the 75th percentile, has kind of been the commonly accepted number in the child care world for a full day, full year experience in high quality child care. And bringing this proposal forward has highlighted that perhaps there are some inequities with using that as the guide. And I think that's a super important discussion to have, and it's a discussion that's central to why we need to look at all of these programs together, all of these funding streams together, really understand how they're working together, how they're not working, how they're working on a regional basis, and having this director position, having this coordination, and this intentional approach to what I think of as a portfolio of investments meant to support young children's access to early education will allow us to have some of these conversations and learn more and make better informed policy.
Member questions, Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe a question to Mr. Gehring from, and that's why we have you here. But according to the bill, we're creating a whole new Department of Administration, which I think the entire bill then is under a preview to ask questions on. I just want to make sure I'm not straying too far. Is there a specific section we should only be looking at?
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, so the purview of the Government Operations Committee is really to review portions of bills that relate to the structure and operation of government. So like in this, and there's certainly some discretion for the chair to decide what the scope of that jurisdiction is. In this bill, I think I would point to Section 4, which is the creation of the Office of the Director within the Department of Administration, and you have the qualifications and compensation and those types of sort of administrative structures of the office traditionally would be within the scope of this committee, and then the substance of the programs that they're administering are historically sort of the jurisdiction of the other policy committees.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. So you're saying even though it's Section 5 is about program administration and how it's administered, that's still not under a purview since it would be a new state agency?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, so the funding streams would be the purview of a finance committee, and this is not a finance committee.
Okay, thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, if you...
Representative Joachim.
I do have one question quick for Representative Loon. Chair Loon, was there any thought to maybe keeping this? I know we already have Department of Education looking at some of these funds and Health and Human Services. Now you're pulling in a third department, and I'm really worried about that continual fragmentation and pulling these programs apart. And I'm only thinking of it as some personal experience I had this last year working in early childhood special ed in a program that also had pre-K and also had public school programs. And we were able to more easily, because it was all under community ed, transfer those kids, and our K-12 system transfer those kids in between classes where they could get the most help. So I'm really concerned about fragmenting out the early childhood special ed from a preschool program, because those kids should be integrated, because they're going to be integrated when they get to K-12. So is there a reason why you are pulling it into a third department?
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would also ask Ms. Moss to respond. But I think, you know, again, I don't know if there's a perfect solution to this. But, you know, some of the efforts preceding this, there was someone housed within the Department of Education a few years ago that was working at trying to coordinate that, but they didn't really have the authority to work necessarily across those agency silos, if you will. We now have the Children's Cabinet, which is sort of under the auspices of the governor in doing some of these things. The legislation and how the director is structured is sort of modeled on the director for school trust lands, which, again, was a position that sort of has educational purposes and intent that emanate from the Constitution as well as environmental and working with the DNR. And so that's kind of how this was structured, to try to find a position that could work and have authority to work and make decisions, but across functions that exist in various agencies or departments.
Follow-up, Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. Having you compare it to that actually makes me more nervous, because the school trust lands is about funding land, not kids. It's talking about the money in the land and what you can make off of it, and not what where the money goes with the kids. So I still am concerned, because you also have community ed, which is usually under K through 12, which a lot of those funds in our school district in Hopkins and in St. Louis Park, they're able to serve more kids because they can be creative and they can be flexible and they can utilize that money to the best of their ability within the community ed program attached to the K through 12 system. So now that's going to be separated out too. So I'm just, as this goes through the process, I'm really concerned if that you're still talking to the stakeholders. I don't serve on education, so I wasn't able to hear the discussion this morning, but I did hear that there was a lot of folks there that are worried and concerned, and that maybe this bill is going through really fast and they haven't had a lot of time to put some input into it. I mean, the fact that you're dual tracking it under two different bills is probably what's causing some of the consternation. So I just wanted to voice those concerns. Thank you.
Carolyn? Thank you, Representative Joaquim. And I appreciate the concerns that you're raising, and I am, again, very diligently trying to make sure that I'm listening to all stakeholders. And, again, I think the urgency with the dual track is only because of the very rapid policy deadline. We've got more time to continue working on this, that it's going to go to education, finance, and we'll be spending a fair amount of time on it there.
Seeing no other member questions, Chair O'Driscoll renews his motion that House File 1958 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries, and you are on your way to State GovFi, Chair Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Thank you so much. Next on the agenda, we have Representative Jessup in House File 2174. And that will be headed to the General Register. Representative Jessup, would you like to move your bill?
Chair of this, Chair Nash, yes, I certainly would. Members of the committee, House File 2174 will allow Ramsey County to create 5 full-time equivalent supported work positions within the county. Hire individuals who have disabilities and who require the continued engagement of a work coach. This will provide employment to approximately 5 to 15 people, depending on the number of hours per week they're worked. This plan will contribute to the efforts Ramsey County is making to recognize the importance of the Minnesota Olmsted Plan in their operations. The Olmsted Plan is a comprehensive plan approach to provide opportunities for those who have disabilities to develop as fully as possible the lives that they choose. Employment in the community is one of the options for people with disabilities to consider and pursue. Several advocacy entities requested that their support for this bill be noted and communicated to the committee, and this includes ARC of Minnesota, Legal Aid Disability Law Center, and a disability provider, Caposia, who works for Ramsey County. The Department of Human Services has also indicated their support. No entity has expressed any opposition to the bill. There is no state cost involved in this, and I've been told there could actually be some potential savings. Here with me today to tell you more about the program is Melissa Huberty from Ramsey County.
Ms. Huberty, welcome to the committee. If you would, state your name and to whom you represent, and then proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Melissa Huberty. I'm the Division Director of Adult Services in the Social Services Department of Ramsey County, and thank you for the opportunity to come before you today to ask for your support of House File 2174. Under this bill, Ramsey County would be authorized to set up a supported work program for people with disabilities who require the continued support of a job coach. The program would mirror one that's already in place at the state level. This employment initiative reflects the goals of the Minnesota Olmsted Plan, which supports people with disabilities in exploring employment options, including meaningful and sustained employment in the community. Essentially, this bill allows Ramsey County to offer real jobs for real people. While many other counties are looking at different ways of engaging the Olmsted Plan in regards to their own workforce, Ramsey County would be the first county in the state to use this particular approach, which is built on direct employment. Individuals working with the county under this program would be actual employees. Currently, we have a number of individuals that require job coaches working with the county through a vendor. With this supported work program, individuals with disabilities can experience the benefits of employment and then make an informed choice about whether that fits for that person. Employment options are a key element of the state's Olmsted Plan in helping people with disabilities live their lives to the fullest extent. So while each person's situation is different, the Social Security Administration has built in many safeguards into the benefits program, like the one proposed in this bill that encourage employment without the loss of benefits for people covered under the Olmsted Act. The program that Ramsey County seeks to develop with passage of this bill will provide a number of jobs in the community that do not interfere with the other benefits that the individuals with disability need in order to engage fully in the community. As I mentioned previously, Ramsey County has successfully worked with individuals with developmental disabilities on site with a job coach through a vendor, and we've experienced the benefits of having an inclusive workforce of all people, and we really would like to have the opportunity to extend that to hire people directly as employees. The supported work plan that can be offered with the enactment of this bill is another step forward towards full integration of people with disabilities in the community. That concludes my remarks, and I stand for questions. If you have any questions regarding the human resources aspects of this proposal, with me today is Jean Gramling, who's the manager of Ramsey County Human Resources. Thank you so much.
Members, questions for the testifier? Seeing none, Ms. Huberty, thank you. Stand by, there might be some others. Are there any members of the public that would like to testify on this bill? Very well. Member questions? Anyone? Anyone? Once? Twice? Okay. Representative Jessup, last words.
We greatly appreciate your support, members of this committee, and Chairman Nash.
Okay, Representative Jessup renews his motion to send House File 2174 to the General Register. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? You're on your way. Okay. Chair O'Driscoll is taking back the helm.
We will now take up House File 1393, which we did have a hearing on a week or so ago, and that is the June primary bill. And so we will bring this forward to move House File 1393 to be re-referred to the General Register. And with that, Representative Fenton, I'm going to give you just a moment to go ahead and set up the genesis of the bill. We'll ask if there's any public testimony, take member questions, and apparently we also do have a couple of amendments that we might want to be looking at. So, Representative Fenton, if you can just for the committee's benefit, remind us of what we're looking at in House File 1393.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And again, following up from the previous hearing, this House File 1393 moves our primary date from August up to June. And so with that, I will entertain the amendments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. Is there anyone from the public wishing to testify on House File 1393, which is before the committee? Seeing none and hearing none, let's move to amendments and to member questions. A couple of different amendments. Is anyone willing to offer any of the amendments that we see here?
Mr. Chair, I'll offer the A1 amendment.
Representative Nelson offers the A1 amendment to House File 1393. Representative Nelson to the A1 amendment.
And Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment is an early voting amendment. It's to, I know earlier we had a bill, I think Representative Fenton carried it, to expand the time where the in-person absentee ballot could be done, but this is an early voting piece that instead of going through the rigmarole of that, just do the early voting, and that's what this amendment does. And Mr. Chair, that's what the amendment is.
Representative Fenton to the A1 amendment as the bill's author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I would urge a no vote. I understand and agree somewhat with where you're going with this, but we did hear my bill, which is very similar in terms of streamlining the in-person absentee voting. Not only that, but currently a fiscal note was requested for House File 1393, and the fiscal note is zero. In speaking with the Secretary of State's office, this amendment would have a fiscal impact on the Secretary of State's office because they would need to do computer programming, so I urge a no vote.
Ms. Brothers, from the Secretary's office, maybe confirm the comments that were offered by the bill author. Ms. Brothers, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. We didn't want you to sit here all afternoon without having a chance to see at least something for the committee. So if you would have to the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Secretary of State's office. This would have a fiscal impact because we would be required to do programming. The benefit of the bill that expands the in-person absentee direct ballot, I forget what we're calling it, but we can stick the ballot in the tabulator. It's still considered an absentee ballot and still tracked in our system as an absentee ballot. Early voting, which our office is in full support of, would require that we create a different method to track early voting in the system. So,
seeing no other questions from members on the A1 amendment, all those in favor of the A1?
I'd like a roll call.
Roll call being requested. Clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pugh? Bliss?
No.
Fenton?
No.
Freiberg? Halverson? Jessup?
No.
Lee? Mason?
Yes, she
said. Representative Mason?
We're voting on this.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nash?
No, thank you.
Nelson?
Yes. Halverson's here.
Peterson? Quam?
No.
Samstead? Fudzinski?
No.
Tice?
No.
West?
No.
You, Joaquim?
Yes.
Halverson?
Yes.
Samstead?
Nope.
Yep. I'm here too. Robert?
Yes. Do you want to ask Lee? He's now back. So I'm, all of a sudden we have members just continuing to appear from who knows where.
Lee?
Yes.
6 ayes and 10 nays. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. There are other amendments for the committee to consider. Anyone interested in offering any of the other amendments? Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A4 amendment.
Representative Halverson offers the A4 amendment to House File 1393. To the A4 amendment, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a bill that many of us have heard in the Government Operations Committee. I know it was calendared for a hearing this year, and we didn't get there, so I'm bringing it forward in this regard. It helps define express advocacy, and, of course, we are all familiar with the dark money that invades many of our districts with regard to campaigns. And it meets a public expectation that we will have transparency when it comes to who is paying for advertising and funding within campaigns. And I strongly encourage a yes vote on the A4 amendment.
Discussion of the A4 amendment. Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor of the A4 amendment
signify. Mr. Chair, can I get a roll call on this, please?
You sure can. Roll call being requested. I'm sorry, Representative Fenton, I suspect I know where you're going to go with this, but I will certainly hear from you.
So, members, I urge a no vote. This is a campaign finance amendment. We have no policy position on this. This is a June primary, so this is a policy bill. Kent Sulem with the townships was here. He had to leave, but I did get a message that he had a concern with the publication requirements in this bill. So I urge a no vote.
Member discussion. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I thought she was giving a germaneness argument, and in committee the germaneness rule that we have on the floor doesn't matter, even though it's a different piece. But I thought that's where she was going with her argument.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions by members? Seeing none and hearing none, the clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Bliss?
No.
Fenton?
No.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Halverson?
Yes.
Jessup?
No.
Lee?
Yes.
Mason?
Yes.
Nash?
Nope.
Nelson?
Yes.
Quam?
No.
Samstead?
Yes.
Swierczynski?
No.
Heiss?
No.
West?
No.
Youakim?
Yes.
There being 7 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chair? Can I offer the A3 amendment, please?
Representative Youakim offers the A3 amendment to House File 1393 to the A3 amendment. Representative Youakim.
Thank you. And this is House File 245. It's Representative Schultz's bill, and I'm on as a co-author, so I thought I'd offer it. And this merely makes you automatically registered when you apply for your driver's license. You'd be registered to vote upon verification of eligibility. So we have to make sure people are actually eligible to vote. And it places an opt-out box on the form, so if you choose not to be registered to vote when you fill out your driver's license, you don't have to be.
Representative, the bill author, Representative Benton to the amendment.
Members, I would urge a no vote. I appreciate the intent from Representative Youakim, but given the deadlines, if we accept the amendment, this would require the bill to go to civil law for the data sharing. And then transportation as well, because of the changes for the DVS, that the DVS would have to make. So I urge a no vote.
Member questions, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Youakim, is there a fiscal note associated with your amendment? Because it seems to me like there would be a cost to sign all those people up.
Representative Youakim to Representative Nash's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. I suppose it would depend on when I went to fiscal committee if that note came about. So, no, not currently.
Okay.
And not as the original bill was introduced.
Other member discussion to the A3 amendment. All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
No. No. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and disappointed that we couldn't agree on helping to regulate dark money, but I do think that we can do a lot to help increase voting among young people, which is one of the major hurdles that we are facing as a state, by putting forward the A2 amendment, which has been carried in the past by Representative Erdahl, but proudly brought to us by a constituent of mine who was in high school at the time, who wanted to help with the pre-registration of young people. No one would be eligible to vote before 18 as constitutionally mandated, but we would pre-register people who are at least 16 years old or older, so that once they turn 18, their registration is processed through the Secretary of State's office, and they become voters. We know science tells us that if you are registered to vote, you are more likely to vote. And the very sad small turnout that we have among voters under 20 years old in our state and in our country is something that we as policymakers really should be dealing with. We need to get those folks' voices heard in our democracy, and so I urge a yes vote on the A2 amendment, please.
Representative Fenton, the bill author to the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I urge a no vote. As a former teacher, I always appreciate trying to get the youth involved. We do already have this for 17-year-olds if they are 18 by the next election. And I remember that hearing last year with Representative Erdahl, and I will say that there was a compromise, key compromise language that is not in this as well. So, members, I urge a no vote.
Mr. Chair,
member question.
Roll call.
Roll call being requested. Member questions? Seeing none and hearing none, the clerk will take the roll on the A2 amendment.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pugh? Bliss?
No.
Fenton?
No.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Halverson?
Yes.
Jessup?
No.
Lee?
Yes.
Mason?
Yes.
Nash?
Nope.
Nelson?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Quam?
Nay.
Samstead?
Yes.
Swadzinski?
No.
Tice?
No.
West?
No.
You, Joaquim?
Yes.
To the A2 amendment, there being 7 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chair, I request a roll call on the bill.
No one going to be offering. I have an A5, or is that a duplicate? No one offering an A5 amendment today? Right. Member discussion. Seeing no member discussion, there was no public hearing, a roll call being requested. I will renew my motion that House File 1393, as amended in the previous committee, be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Bliss?
Yes.
Fenton?
Yes.
Freiberg?
No.
Halverson?
No.
Jessup?
Yes.
Lee?
No.
Mason?
No.
Nash?
Yep.
Nelson?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Quam?
Aye, aye.
Samstead?
No.
Swadzinski?
Yes.
Tice?
Yes.
West?
Yes.
Yul Joaquim?
No.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Samstead.
Does Representative Quam's vote count as one or two?
One.
Thank you.
And for the record, it does not neutralize itself with two no's or two negatives, just so we're clear on that. There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does prevail. House File 1393, as amended, is referred to the General Register. The next bill that we have is Representative Quam, House File 1888. Representative Quam, I will move House File 1888 to be re-referred to the General Register. To House File 1885, the bill author, Representative Quam.
Thank
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this bill is simply expanding the gift law to prohibit members of the staff of the Minneapolis Sports Authority. That's the U.S. Bank Stadium, in case you weren't familiar from recent testimonies, and the Minnesota Ballpark Authority, that's Target Field, from giving gifts to certain officials. Fairly straightforward. Thank you.
Member questions. Representative Quam. Representative Nash to House File 1888. I'm sorry, Representative Nelson.
You look a lot alike.
Yes, you do.
Around the eyes, both handsome devils.
Representative Nelson, anytime you're ready.
What you got now?
I've got to get myself together here. Question, Representative Quam. Would this prohibit an employee of the Sports Facility Commission or the Ballpark Authority from giving political contributions to through the normal political contributions system?
Representative Fong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, this, along with the other portions of the gift ban, do not preclude that, so I would not see that this would be an issue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I just have a concern that we're, If this would do that, that we're taking away the political voice and the political right of members of our citizens of our state. So that's a concern I have, but we can check on this later and make sure I know this when he hits the floor.
Very good. Other member questions at this time? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, is it your intention, and does this bill clarify the fair market value of access to things like a stadium suite or things that would not be available to the public under normal circumstances? So does that clarify that particular concern at all? I know we had some discussion on the House floor about that.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, basically, it doesn't change anything within the scope definition or range of the gift law, other than extending it upon another group. So therefore, if there's an existing definition you're concerned about, it's not being changed from current law.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my interpretation of gift law would be that we would indeed clarify that anything that is available to a member of the public would be included in this, as well as anything that's not available, so like access to privately owned suite that a general member of the public wouldn't have access to, regardless of whether or not somebody paid for it or not.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, this bill doesn't affect any definitions and is agnostic to interpretations of gifts.
Other member questions? Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Quam. This to me seems so much duplicate of our regular campaign finance deals. So I guess the question is, why do you think this is necessary?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, basically, there have been concerns about the activities of some of these sports commissions. And frankly, I think that the members and citizens of our state deserve to have it very clear that we don't want to have any low standards. We want to have the highest standards for these entities where we pour hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion or more, into, and therefore extending existing gift ban law to try and give reassurance to our citizens is but a trifling thing to do for Minnesota.
Representative Halverson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I think that transparency I think that our current gift ban is actually a really good reassurance for the public, and I don't have any trouble extending it. In fact, I think we had a very similar conversation on the House floor on a similar amendment recently. So It's clear that there are bipartisan interests in making sure that there's important transparency in that situation. So, thanks.
Other member questions at this time? Representative Freiberg.
Just wondering, if this, why this targets, I don't see a problem with it particularly. Just if there are issues, there are other entities, whether you're talking about the Destination Medical Center or just various boards and commissions set up in state law that this would not apply to. I just double-checked the definition of official. I think that excludes local officials. Just wondering why you didn't, if this is an issue, why shouldn't it be done more broadly than it's done in this bill?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Frankly, the media, citizens, and the public have shown a little bit of interest in these entities. And I thought it was appropriate to go ahead and show them that we heard their concerns and that we're trying to do something to make it more plain that we won't allow shenanigans.
Representative Freiberg, follow.
Okay, I guess that's fair that there's been some concern about these two. So should local officials then also be prohibited from receiving gifts from them, just out of curiosity?
Representative Quan.
Mr. Chair, frankly, I think the definition in the bill of officials is fine and adequate for my, for me. I didn't see any amendments to clarify that, so I'm fine with it.
Mr. Gehring, did you have some observations you might want to share with the committee at this time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, just to clarify the scope of the gift law, so it does include local officials of metropolitan government units. So the three kind of groups of entities that are covered by the gift law currently are public officials, and these are, they've got statewide officials and county commissioners. Legislative staff are included, and then also metropolitan local government officials, so like the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul and other surrounding area officials would be included currently.
Any other member questions at this time? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1888 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion carries. The next two bills that we have on the agenda, we'll start with House File 2073. Representative Drazkowski is making his way to the testifiers table, and I will move House File 2073 to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Representative Drazkowski, Chair Drazkowski, welcome to the committee, sir. I'll ask you to background the bill and its purpose before the committee, and then we'll proceed from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2073 is a bill to repeal and end the state's public subsidy program. As I think most members know, this is these are straight checks that the state cuts to political campaigns each election cycle, and they're kind of in two parts. One is a checkoff initiator where somebody filling out their taxes can actually designate that they would like $5 for an individual or $10 per couple designated to a particular party, and the other one is a candidate-specific disbursement that happens from the general fund. This, I had the fiscal note out, I think amounted in the last time, and I don't know that I have a fiscal note yet this time, Mr. Chair. I know this is not a fiscal committee, but the questions will likely come up, but it was about about $2.6 million per biennium last time for this particular part of what we're looking at here. So what the bill does is it repeals each of these programs, and then in order to make the campaign finance laws whole within statutes, actually replaces the campaign subsidy spending agreement that is signed with the campaign subsidy pledge, simply a pledge to follow the spending guidelines within your political activity. So that's the bill, and I appreciate your support.
Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 2073? Anyone from the public wishing to testify on House 2073, which is before the committee? Seeing none, member questions at this time. Representative Freiberg, followed by Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Druskowski, this is an interesting approach, just putting a voluntary pledge into state statute, as this bill would do. Is there any enforcement mechanism should a candidate pledge to abide by the spending limits but not subsequently do so? Is there any way to recoup the money, or are there any monetary penalties imposed for not doing that?
Representative Chair Druskowski.
Mr. Chair, maybe Ms. Dyson can help us with the specifics of that question. But in terms of enforcement, Representative Freiberg, what would happen is that when we run for office, our credibility and our character are a spotlight amongst the electorate about how we operate. Certainly, if an individual candidate would pledge to follow the rules and then be found to not follow the rules, it would have significant political ramifications, and I think that the electorate would really provide the judge, jury, and trial on that behavior throughout that. So a political opponent could say, you know what, this individual pledged to follow the rules, written signature, and broke that pledge to the people of the state of Minnesota. So I think that's exactly what we would see happen.
Representative Freiberg, follow-up?
Just a comment. I say, you know, it's, I don't even know if it's accurate to say that the candidate pledged to follow the rules, because there really aren't any rules anymore if this were to become law.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I personally feel this is going in the wrong direction. I think generally the people that I know are just so frustrated with the amounts of money that are being spent on campaigns, and what they would rather see is maybe certain things that would apply to everybody, like everybody gets one television commercial or something. And I think also the amounts of money that are coming in now are huge, and I know we have a real hard time trying to figure out how to deal with all the extra money. But the other thing that I think is even more important is that I think it's important for people to feel that they are part of government. And I think this gives many people the opportunity to do that. So I just really think this is really not something that is going to help our situation and getting people to feel connected with government.
So Representative Mason, more of a statement than a question to the author?
He could respond, because I think it's an interesting, again, the bill is.
Chair Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mason. And this bill, actually both of these two bills that we have in line here, did pass through this committee 2 years ago, and I know the PCR portion passed as part of the omnibus tax bill, and I think that the repeal of the public subsidy program passed as part of the state government finance, but I could be wrong on that. I think it did. But what we're looking at here is, some of us and a lot of people in Minnesota look at this as simply as self-serving political welfare, and that's what we have here is we've got these are public tax dollars that are collected from the people of Minnesota, the millions of people in our state, against their will, and then we as a legislature are largely keeping these going in somewhat a self-serving role, I would assert, because we are the recipients. Everyone in this room received a $3,000 to $5,000 check during their last campaign and the one before that and the one before that from this program. And I think a lot of Minnesotans would rather see their hard-earned tax dollars either returned to them in the form of reduced tax cuts, or some may want to see more money for education or to fix our roads or other things, and those are really good and legitimate debates, I think, to have. We don't have to look too much further than the last election when Donald Trump, running for President of the United States, said we need to start draining the swamp. I can't see a more putrid and evident example of swamp than us having policy here in the state of Minnesota where the legislature supports and the governor supports legislation or policy that takes taxpayers' money and gives it to us to run our elections. And back to your question or assertion there, Representative Mason, I don't think that passage of this bill is going to affect the other problem you brought up. And I think a lot of us share that concern about a lot of the outside money, whether you're Republican, Democrat, incumbent, or challenger. But the passage of this bill is not going to change that.
Representative Mason.
Thank you very much. I take issue with a number of things that you said, but first of all, we are trying to maintain a democratic government, and for people not to expect that they should participate in that, I think, is wrong. So I think this really gives them a chance to be part of the government, part of the process. And when you're talking about the point about draining the swamp, now, if you look at the people that have been appointed, they're millionaires and billionaires. Now, how is the swamp being drained? You're just changing one group of people for another people that, again, that have a lot of money, a lot of influence, and what I think your bill also is doing is trying to take away power from the people.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, is the checkoff box on your taxes voluntary?
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Joaquin, it is. People can volunteer or opt or not opt might be the better option or the better way to state it. To check off and designate taxpayer dollars from the general fund to go to a certain place, and that's how it operates. It doesn't affect your refund or the amount of money that you owe. It simply designates existing general fund money in the allotment of $5 or $10 for singles or couples.
Representative Joaquin, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski. So it is voluntary. You made it sound like it was forced. You have to check off the box, then that money is designated. And I worry about this because it really does level the playing field for first-time candidates, for candidates challenging a powerful incumbent. People are really tired of all the money being spent in campaigns, and if we took off the caps and made it voluntary to follow caps, I can't even imagine how exponentially money will be flowing into campaigns and really making the playing field unlevel. We've seen it already when it comes to outside spending, where outside spending money trumps any voice the candidate has in connecting to their constituents. So, you know, this bill may look simple, but it's pretty dangerous. So just my thoughts.
Representative Halverson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're
and
welcome.
Anytime. Well, I think that this is a really interesting discussion because I do think it is important for us to think about why we have the rules that we operate under as a state. Minnesota put the public subsidy program in place, interestingly enough, as a response to Watergate, as a response to the public feeling like its voice was being cut out of government, and as a response to the growing power of special interests and political parties. And here we are talking about repealing it. And we really need to make sure that we do everything we can to help the individual voters leverage their voice in our democracy. Today, I think more than ever, our constituents are looking for ways to make sure that their voices count. And the spending limits that we adhere to as part of the subsidy program help us get there. The ability for folks, and obviously we don't always fund this program from year to year, but the ability of folks to choose where public dollars go for candidates really empowers their voice in the political process. And taking that away ensures that special interests and ensures that political parties are going to be the beneficiaries, not the individual members of the public. We need to make sure that we are supporting the individual members of the public to make their voices competitive
with the influx of dark money that many people are competing with in terms of getting their message out and having conversations in their communities. Minnesota also has a real history of supporting independent candidates. We're the reason that we have a DFL party and not a Democratic party like the rest of the country is because third parties have found ways to gain power in Minnesota. For a very long time, we were the independent Republican Party instead of the Republican Party because independents made a difference in Minnesota. And instead, we're going to consolidate power in our political parties by removing the voice of the people from this. And we're also going to give independent candidates and challenger candidates less of a chance. If you are an independent candidate, third-party candidate that's not going to that's going to challenge an incumbent, you have a distinct disadvantage, and incumbents have a distinct advantage. People who are backed by a political party have a distinct advantage over people who are not. And this is part of making sure that independent voices can be part of the process. And it's been very successful in Minnesota. So I would encourage you not to consolidate power into the political parties and special interests and not support this bill.
Seeing no other member questions, the A1 amendment, I suspect Representative Freiberg.
Well, I don't know. Do you think I should?
We've got time.
You know, as long as we're talking about things out of Washington, I mean, you know, draining the swamp and whatnot, this is the alternative fact amendment that has been submitted here. I don't think I'm going to offer it. Obviously, it's not the most serious of amendments here. This is actually a pretty serious issue that we're talking about. I think Representative Halverson put it very eloquently here. I think this will, if this passes, it will increase the influence of special interests of individuals and corporations with lots of money. I think the system put in place in the wake of Watergate that she described is a unique and eloquent way of handling this. It requires us not to conserve our resources and not spend a lot of money in order to be put on a level playing field with potentially other serious candidates. So, I do think it will just lead to the influence of outside groups, outside spending, outside mailers on the campaigns that will contain alternative facts. The amendment was prepared somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but I think it does point to some serious issues that will become more serious if this bill were to pass and become law.
Just a point, thank you, Representative Pfeiffer. Just a point of clarification. There was some conversation about drain the swamp. I have received a notice from a member who has read the bill. There is no environmental references in there, so the bill does not need to go to the Environment Committee, just for everyone's clarification, because we have had some questions today regarding that. Seeing no other member questions, I will renew my motion that House File 2073 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No. No.
The motion prevails. The bill is re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Our final bill today, House File 2072, I'll bring it before the committee to be laid over. Representative Drazkowski, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2072 simply repeals the political contribution refund program, which is the other piece of political welfare that we have in statute. Right now and over the last 2 years, I think members have realized that this program has not been funded over the last 2 years, and should the legislature and the governor together not opt to fund it again this time, it will continue to be unfunded, or if they don't change anything in law, as I understand it, we'll go back and be funded again at somewhere in the area of give or take $9 or $10 million per biennium is the amount of impact of this particular one. So it repeals a program. I think Mr. Sigurdsson is here from the Campaign Finance Board. I don't know if he wants to talk or not. Mr. Chair, there's a, for members that are interested, there's a There's a report on this program that was issued in 2014 that's available, or excuse me, November 25th, 2015, that is available that talks about all the details and who takes the most from this particular political welfare program.
With that, I do have one testifier who's been patiently waiting this afternoon. Mr. Beck, if you would like to come forward, we certainly do want to hear from you. And Mr. Sigerson, I don't know if you are available for questions or need to testify, but we'll certainly hear from you as well. All right. Mr. Beck, welcome to the committee this afternoon, sir. I would ask that you state your name, who you represent, and please proceed with your testimony. Again, welcome, sir.
My name is George Beck, and I'm chair of Minnesota Citizens for Clean Elections. I'm a former chair of the Campaign Finance Board. Minnesota Citizens for Clean Elections is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that promotes electoral policies that reflect the will of the people and not the power of money. I'd like to briefly point out the benefits of this refund program for the people of Minnesota and the reasons it strengthens our democracy. The program increases the proportional importance of small donors in average Minnesotans so that candidates do not depend as much on large contributors, lobbyists, or special interests. It encourages legislators to look to all constituents and creates a stronger relationship between them. It supports first-time candidates, can increase the diversity of candidates, and the number of contested seats. It eliminates income as a significant factor for participation, and it encourages voters to participate in political campaigns. It limits spending in political campaigns, and it means less time spent fundraising by elected officials. A study by the Center for Governmental Studies stated that Minnesota's public finance program has for decades been considered one of the finest in the nation, with a higher participation rate than other states. And in 2014, 88.5% of candidates participated. At a time when the influx of large sums of money in politics threatens the legitimacy of our democratic processes, and when cynicism is increasing among voters, this program becomes even more important. Legislators should not be beholden to special interests that seek to dominate decision-making. This program has excellent public support. 62% of American citizens support public financing, and 85% support fundamental change in campaign finance. So we are asking that you vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Beck, thank you. I'll just ask you to hang tight and see if there's any member questions for you. Seeing none, with the thanks to the committee, appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 2072? Anyone wishing to testify on House File 2072? Seeing no other testimony, member questions. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're kind of on the same road that we were with the last bill, and if you want to, you know, cast off all the kind of contracts we have with the public with regard to how campaigns are run and what the public expects from us. The comment that you made in the, on the last bill that people will just vote us out if we do something politically wrong. I think the fact that as much as we've spent time debating gift bans and other quote-unquote perks for elected officials, importantly, this session, shows that that's not true. The public wants us to abide by rules, and the public wants to be part of the process in a meaningful and powerful way. More and more, they're finding their voices are being diminished. When you look at any time the public is saying, how do we get more candidates to run? How do we get new candidates to run? How do we get individuals to challenge incumbents? The answer is very often make sure that there is public subsidy available for those people who come from the powerless, who don't have the leg up, either because they're an incumbent or they're backed by a political party or whatever the case may be. This is not about protecting incumbency and feathering our own electoral mess. This is about making sure that voices of the powerless have an opportunity to be heard in a arena that is increasingly dominated
by big money special interests. I want our campaigns for the state legislature to be about our communities, and I want our constituents and our small donors to have the power to say where these public dollars go. And Minnesota's public subsidy or public refund program has put the power in the hands of the citizens. We have said, as Minnesotans, that we want to be sure that the powerless have a leg up, and that through this program, the public gets to decide where those dollars go. Talk about power for the people. I don't think we should be taking this away from our constituents.
Other member questions at this time? Seeing none, Representative Draskowski, I am going to lay over House File 2072. No other business before the committee. We are adjourned. 9 a.m. tomorrow in the basement hearing room, just as a reminder.